We have Senate bills. There will be a few bills that we will consider later, but for the majority of them, today is going to be they live or die. And it's actually going to be kind of an interesting day on some of these bills. We have heard all the ones in work session in public hearing over the last few months, and to be totally candid on some of these bills, I just don't know what the vote's going to be. So it will be rather interesting to see how some of these go. But we've got a couple of things we want to get out of the way right away. So let's open a work session on Senate Bill 579. And Teresa, this is the bill on guides.
Yes, that's right.
And we had a correction that we wanted to put in, and maybe you could go over that with us real quickly.
Yes, and the Dash 2 amendments, the State Marine Board at our work session on Tuesday wanted a slight change on line 6. So right now on the Dash 3 amendments, it's changed to, the phrase has been changed to correct the terminology.
Okay.
To reflect their standards.
Okay, and then that was, and then specifically that was?
The direct operation of an outfit and guide, or an employee of an outfitter and guide. Yes.
Okay. So that was the one change that we weren't going to conceptually amend it, so we didn't get in trouble. And it is now in there. Senator Atkinson, does that reflect the amendment that you wrote?
Yes. Are we in work session?
We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, move the dash three.
Senator Atkinson has moved the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 579. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended before with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 579 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. For Carrier, whose bill is that?
Senator
Przanski. All right, let's ask Senator Przanski to carry, and in lieu of that, it would be Senator Atkinson, but we'll ask Senator Przanski to carry. Okay, let's open a public hearing on HJR 8A, designates the pear as the official state fruit. And we're going to ask Representative Patty Smith to come forward, and one of the other sponsors, along with myself, Senator Atkinson, is here off the dais. So welcome, Representative.
Well, thank you, Senator and honorable committee members. I'm Representative Patty Smith. I represent District 52, and I'm very pleased that you're hearing this bill today. Thank you, Senator Metzger, for being the co-sponsor on this important bill.
Well, I want you to know, Representative, before you go, is that we're very magnanimous on the Senate side. We'll actually even hear House bills, even though we have Senate bills on this side of it. So we're welcome.
You are so gracious. No comment? Is that allowed? I think there's people here that will make the case for making pears our state fruit, and I'm going to let them come up. And I know you wanted to do this in a timely manner. So I've written, submitted testimony in written form why I'm supporting this bill. We passed it in the Ag and Natural Resource Committee unanimously, and we passed it in the House unanimously. And pears are awesome. So that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Representative. Any questions for Representative Smith? Okay, we'll let you get back to your duty. Thank you very much. We have the Blossom Court, by the way, the Hood River Shipper and Growers Association, and I think we saw them on the House and Senate floor, and it's great to have you guys here today. We have Senator Esquivel here, let's bring him. I mean, Representative Esquivel. Oh, you can see what Senator Esquivel. I mean, he's both. So, welcome from the southern part of the state.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I did a little bit of knowledge. I do have a little bit of knowledge of this particular fruit since when I was a kid, I used to thin them, irrigate them, smudge them, and pick them. This has been a long-standing viable industry in Southern Oregon. Our largest, in fact, employer in Southern Oregon is Bear Creek Corporation, which is in Southern Oregon, right outside the city of Medford. Although we have lost the number one designation for having the most pears, but I do want to add we have the best pears, in my opinion. So, The pear is a very integral part, and if you look at the exportation of that and how it's done nationwide as well as internationally, it is a fine, fine commodity that we have. And Senator Atkinson will probably agree with me. We do have great, great pears in Southern Oregon, and it's something that is very good for our economic development as well as internationally known. I mean, everybody in the United States knows Harry and David or Bear Creek. I mean, they don't know where Medford is, but they certainly know Bear Creek and Harry and David. So anyway, with that, I'll let everyone else speak to this, but I wanted to come in and tell you that this is a very, very good bill, and I think that we need this.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative. Okay, for our testimony, if there is one member of the Blossom Court who would like to come forward along with Kevin Moffitt and John McCauley, will be our testimony. Sir.
You scared him, Mr. Chair.
I know. Now, if you all four want to come up, come on up.
They're not going to draw straws.
Yeah. Welcome, ladies, again. Thank you for spending the day. It's nice that we do share.
We should try that. Our committee.
Yeah. Share. Welcome.
That's all right.
Please introduce yourself.
Senator Metzger, members of the committee, on behalf of all of us, thank you for this opportunity to testify today regarding HJR 8A. Designating the pear as Oregon State's fruit. My name is Danny Peters. I'm a junior at the Hood River Valley High School. I'm one of the four members of the Hood River Grower Shipper 2005 Blossom Court. We were selected last Wednesday, March 30th, from 25 applicants for the scholarship program.
Great.
My name is Lisa Perry. I'm a junior at Hood River Valley High School, and I am very excited to have been chosen to be a Blossom Court member for 2005. During the next year, we will serve as ambassadors to the Mid-Columbia fruit industry, and this is our first official event, and it's a wonderful opportunity to participate in this legislative process.
And you're so aptly named, Lisa Perry, so it's pretty good.
My name is Ariel McMillan. I'm a junior at Hood River Valley High School. We are honored to have the opportunity to speak to your committee today. Normally, that opportunity would not present itself, as the legislature will not be in session for the majority of our time as ambassadors. We thank Senator Metzger and Representative Patty Smith for offering House Joint Resolution 8A, designating the pear as Oregon State fruit.
My name is Hannah Mason. I am a junior at Hood River Valley High School. We are here today to support HJR 8A, which names the pear as Oregon State's fruit. Pear production is a vital economic factor in the Mid-Columbia and in Jackson County. The pear is a nutritious and healthy food, and we would be honored to have the state recognize the many contributions of Oregon's pear industry with this designation. So thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for gracing the capital today. Any questions for the members of the court? Thank you very much. All right, now we'll ask Mr. Kevin Moffitt from the Pear Bureau Northwest and John McCauley from the Tree Fruit Growers to come forward. And that'll wrap up our testimony, and then we will weigh the benefits of pears. With props. All right.
Mr. Chair, my name is John McCauley. I'm representing the tree fruit growers. These are the growers and shippers in the Mid-Columbia area in Hood River, Wasco counties, in Milton Freewater, in Umatilla County, and in Jackson County in Southern Oregon. I'm just here to share with the committee that because the fruit industry involves not only pears but apples and cherries as well, and those are the growers I represent, I want you to know that there is no opposition to this bill from the cherry and apple growers of the state. The pears is the largest of the tree fruit industries in Oregon, and I think this is a very important bill for marketing that commodity and improving the returns to the growers.
Thank you, John. Welcome.
Good morning, Chairman Metzger, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Moffitt, President and CEO of the Pear Bureau Northwest, and manager of the Winter Pear Control Committee Federal Marketing Order. These organizations were established in the 1930s to help promote research and market fresh pears grown in Oregon and Washington, and my office is located in Milwaukee, Oregon. I'm here to present some facts about the pear crop in Oregon and why it makes sense to make pears the state fruit. And I do know you have a full agenda today, so I appreciate your time, and I will be brief. Oregon currently has an official state dance, insect, and rock, but no official state fruit. While Georgia has the peach, Utah the cherry, and Washington State the apple, no other state lists pears as their state fruit, and frankly, no other state has a stronger case to do so. Why pears? Well, at $72 million in farm gate value in 2003, pears are the top fruit crop in the state and the number 10 overall agricultural crop. Using a multiplier of 1.5 supplied by Oregon State University, this $72 million in farm gate value generates an additional $108 million in income throughout the state. Oregon ranks second in fresh pear production in the country after Washington State, and Oregon's 370 pear growers produce an average of 140 million pounds of Bartlett pears, of which two-thirds are used in processing and one-third marketed fresh. In addition, Oregon growers produce another 264 million pounds of non-Bartlett or winter pears such as Anjou, Bosque, and Camise. These are big numbers. Put another way, Oregon produces enough pears that if they were laid end to end, they would wrap around the world twice. If all the pears were consumed in the state, our growers could supply every Oregon household 2 pears per day, 365 days a year. The three West Coast states produce about 97% of the nation's commercial pear crop. Oregon produces 37% of the nation's fresh pears and 23% of the overall commercial pears in the United States. Approximately 35% of the Oregon's crop is sold in over 40 countries worldwide, including Sweden, Russia, India, and Mexico. I see they're giving you a little taste. I brought some props, too, but those will come in later. Designating pears as a state fruit will lead to an increase in overall awareness of Oregon pears, thereby increasing consumer interest and purchase, resulting in better grower returns, which will also benefit other sectors of our state's economy. There's wide support from our industry. Not only do we have the new Hood River Blossom Court in attendance in the Capitol today, Lee Johnson from Harry and David in Medford is here as well. The Harry and David Company and their fruit-growing operation Bear Creek are fully behind this resolution. The state's pear industry will capitalize on the opportunity in the following ways. We will conduct aggressive PR campaigns to local consumer press and the produce trade press. The Pear Bureau, established in 1931, has the personnel and expertise to reach key media contacts with messages that include the economic impact the pear crop has on our state. We'll introduce pears into the school curriculums, not only through the Blue Book, but also in school lesson plans and promotions in conjunction with serving the state fruit in school cafeterias. We currently conduct far-reaching school programs, including a reading curriculum series featuring Pear Bear Chronicles and a Pear Bear Buddy program that promotes active, healthy lifestyles. The designation will be used in our planned Brand Oregon promotions this fall. We plan to support retail promotion opportunities touting and featuring the state fruit. Likewise, we will work with Oregon restaurants and chefs to develop and feature recipes using the state fruit. Pear mail order companies and pear shippers will be encouraged to utilize the designation to brand and identify their product with pride of origin. And we support the popular agritourism industry in Oregon by encouraging the use of the designation to promote travel to pear-growing regions. All of these activities have the potential to raise the awareness and value of the pear crop in Oregon. Now, thank you very much, and I would be pleased to answer any questions.
Not bad. Questions from the committee? Well, first of all, appreciate very much your efforts on this, and I do believe that this will really, really help market a great product that the state of Oregon produces. And it's a great way tying Southern Oregon with the Hood River Valley and in a mutual support for pears. And I think it's going to be a very, very helpful thing, and it's been great to see the industry do as well as it has been when so many of our other, you know, crops are still struggling. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Senator Montes-Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does the pear compare with berries in particular, Marion berry, raspberry, strawberry.
In terms of value?
In terms of crop value.
Well, my understanding is pears are about $72 million. My understanding on the Marion berry value, I believe, and I don't have the figures in front of me, but I believe the 2003 value was something like $17 million. On, I think, blueberries, strawberries are all in that sort of general area.
And what is pears again? 41.
$72 million.
Is that the follow up? Is that the fruit that has the highest income?
It's the highest value crop in Oregon. The second is cherries at $41 million, and pears also rank as the number 10 overall agricultural crop. But there are no other fruit crops above the pears in value.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you very, very much. We'll send this thing moving. We'll close the public hearing, Senate Bill 171, H.R. 8A, open a work session on H.J.R. 8A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move H.J.R. 8A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved H.J.R. 8A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
I have to make a comment.
Please.
Having grown up Gresham and picked strawberries and raspberries and Marion berries. Well, Marion berries weren't when I was picking. They were actually created by Oregon State University here. I have a bias. I have a bias to the berries. And so I will put that on the record, even though I am going to vote yes for this.
Okay.
So I will probably
record.
You guys have any other bills on this agenda today? Your bias will be noted for the record. Further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Chair will carry. Okay. Congratulations, all of you. Now, let's go. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 171. Colleagues, this is the co-gen bill that we've had before us a number of times with the amendment, which includes the information provided by the Public Utility Commission. There are -6 amendments which require that a regulated energy utility file a deconsolidated tax return. It also says that if there's been 5 years or more from a rate hearing, that a rate hearing will be held. However, the PUC has modified that to allow a utility to make a case why they don't have to have a 5-year hearing. So it will give them an opportunity to make a case for not having to do so. And then the third major element that we discussed, there's 4 major elements. Third major element then would be to allow the PUC to consider federal and state taxes when determining rates for a utility. We've heard extensively on this issue. I think it's really good public policy. The chairman of revenue, however, would like to, and I think it's appropriate, to continue to discuss this issue in the revenue committee. So it would be the chair's desire to pass the -6 amendments into the bill and send the bill to revenue for further consideration.
Just 6 quick questions, Chair.
Yes, Senator Starr.
What's the difference between the -4s and the -6s?
For hearing when the dashboard amendments were introduced, there were some technical questions that arose from the Public Utility Commission, in particular the definition of a utility, and there was a couple of questions also from the Department of Revenue. So it's just clarification of language and questions that came up during the last hearing.
And then the other issue, Senator Starr, which is on page 3, lines 7 through 12, the modification of the 5-year requirement to allow a utility to make a case to the PUC that they should not have to come in for a rate hearing, but they would have the burden of proof to demonstrate why that would not be necessary. Other questions on the amendments?
I haven't gone through them all.
Okay. Is anybody from the PUC here?
Yes.
Well, would you come forward? This might be even more helpful.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
We're just considering the -6s.
Yes, -6s, and then send the bill to the Committee on Revenue.
Okay.
sorry, we have so many people from so many places here, I lose track of, with all our varied bills today.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Willis, Executive Director of the Public Utility Commission. And with me is Paul Graham. He's the Attorney General assigned to our agency, and he can tell you in detail just what those amendments do.
You have them before you, Mr. Graham. Would you please just give us a walkthrough of the amendments for the committee again, please?
Yes, Chair Metzger. What the amendments do is deal with the requirement that the utilities come in within 5 years for a new general rate filing if there hasn't been a general rate change within that time period. There are five key provisions here. First, we use our general investigatory statute, ORS 756, to allow the utility to come in and show why a rate filing isn't necessary. The PUC has the authority to ask them to come in after a five-year period and say, all right, we think a general rate filing is necessary. And then the utility has an opportunity to demonstrate why it thinks one is not necessary. The burden of persuasion, as you already pointed out, is on the utility to do that. So if the utility is unsuccessful, then the commission can order the utility to make a rate filing. It has to give the utility at least 90 days to prepare one and can give more time if need be. The definition, by the way, that we took of a general rate filing is from one of our administrative rules. It's been around for a long time, and everybody, I think, is pretty comfortable with it. But that's basically the way this provision would work. I drafted the language, and I went over it with a representative from Portland General, who was comfortable with it. And then we talked about it at the last commission meeting on Tuesday, and the commission approved it, and then Mr. Willis sent it on over here. So I think it's something that, as far as I know, everybody's comfortable with.
Any questions for? Yes, Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In line 9 on page 3 of the amendment, says the commission may order the public utility to show cause as to why the new filing for general rate revision is not necessary. What kinds of things could it be that the utility could present to the PUC that would kind of get them out of this? I mean, what does that really mean? What are
a couple examples. Let's say the utility has a major resource coming online in, say, 18 months. They might say, why don't you wait 18 months? We have this major resource coming online. That would be a better time to handle this. That's just one example. Or they might say that there are some costs that have increased that are greater than costs that have decreased, and the utility might say, if we do come in, you might wind up with a little bit of a cost increase. And so we're willing to stay away if you're willing not to have us come in. So those are the types of things that could come in. It's very broad language, so it would give the utility the opportunity to have its due process so it could show any reason at all, any reason under the sun, and I've just given you a couple of examples, as to why it's really not necessary to make a general rate change.
And, Mr. Chair,
yes?
What kind of time frame would this process take?
We used the general investigation statute so that we could do this quickly. We could probably do this at a public meeting where we would have maybe the staff of the PUC might come in and recommend that the commission use the authority to require the utility to come in for a general rate filing, and then the utility could come in with its own written submission and offer its reasons as to why it shouldn't. Now, if you needed a more involved process, we could do that. We could even have a process in theory that would involve direct and cross-examination, although I envision that this would probably be handled at a public meeting because the decision is not what the rates are going to be, it's just whether or not there should be a new look at the rates. So it'd probably be a fairly quick process.
Okay, and this last question.
Yes.
And you've shared these amendments with the utilities, and the utilities are in support of these amendments?
I actually worked out the principles here with Pamela Lesh at PGE, and then I shared the language with her. She made one tweak in the language, and that was to allow the commission to have the ability to allow more than 90 days for a rate filing if the commission felt that that was wise, and I made that change. And as far as I know, I haven't heard of any opposition from the utilities. But I did work on the language with Portland General.
What about PacifiCorp?
They were at the meeting. I believe, on Tuesday. I didn't hear any opposition. Mr. Willis?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I believe they were at the meeting, but I don't want to say that they were supportive. I would leave it to them. I don't recall them making a comment one way or the other, so I don't want to present their point of view.
Sure. Yeah, because I know they are opposed to the deconsolidated tax return. Is Kevin here? Lynch?
Yes.
Well, come forward. Kevin? Kevin, you want to come forward just for a moment? Members, and we've heard from Pacific Corps, you know, they don't like the, certainly oppose the deconsolidated tax return. We've heard that. We're now talking about these other amendments and comments, the rest of this stuff. So
right. For the record, Kevin Lynch with Pacific Corp. We have not had the opportunity to review the amendments specifically. I think, you know, generally, I mean, our attorneys haven't parsed all of the words, but generally have a pretty good amount of faith in Paul's legislative drafting, and we don't have a philosophical opposition to being, you know, to looking at coming in every 5 years. I mean, from a practical standpoint, we anticipate in the near future to be in for rate cases on a more frequent basis than that, so it probably wouldn't affect us. So without looking at the specifics of the words for this, I'd say we don't have a problem with this part of the amendments.
Thank you.
Yeah, and just want to make a comment though. First, is that keep going. We're going to be sending this to the Revenue Committee. We will have a public hearing. So if someone wants to comment on this, because of the volume of work today, that public hearing for further discussion on this entire bill with these amendments will take place in Revenue. So with that,
Are we in work session?
Are we in work session?
Well, we do have a public hearing.
Just to make sure I do that. A work session on Senate Bill 171.
Mr. Chair, I move the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 171.
Senator Starr moved the -6 amendments to Senate Bill 171. Further discussion? Any objection? Third.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 171 as amended by the -6 to the Revenue Committee.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 171 as amended to the Revenue Committee. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm willing to move this bill forward with these amendments. I'm not totally convinced that I'm agreeable with everything that's written in here, so I will reserve the right if this bill comes out of Revenue that I might oppose it on the Senate floor. I just want to put that on the record.
Absolutely. Any other further discussion? Any objection? To order. Send it off to Revenue. Okay, now we're just about 1:30. We're trying to keep to our schedule here. We're going to go back now and open up a work session on Senate Bill 151. And
work session, Mr.
Yes, work session.
Yes.
And we have some amendments before us, and we have Dr. Bates here. So if you would come forward, and John Powell, if you would come forward, I believe are the principals here. And colleagues, we heard this bill almost 2 months ago regarding, it was a more extended bill at the time in terms of increasing PIP payments and others. We worked with the insurance industry and produced a few things that were brought out by Mr. Powell that were supported at that time, and we have narrowed that scope to those issues. And then Senator Bates has been working also with others on another issue that would fit comfortably in this bill and is introducing to us today. So with that, Senator Bates, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Alan Bates, State Senator from District 3, Ashland, Medford. Thank you for hearing this amendment, committee members and Mr. Chair. This is actually a fix to a bill that was passed in the last session. You know, the last session was passed a PIP bill. I assume you all know what that stands for. It's a personal injury protection on auto insurance. That bill was designed to increase revenue primarily to hospitals and their trauma centers. As trauma centers at that time and continue to be in serious difficulty as far as being able to fund their services. As a result of that bill, we were hoping to put more money into hospitals so that could occur. We still have a crisis in the state with trauma centers. As an example, in my particular area of the state, if you have a trauma involving a head injury on Thursdays or every other weekend, you will not be taken care of at Rogue Valley. You'll be sent by plane to Portland, Oregon. We're trying to reverse those trends that are occurring across the state. The bill was designed to increase the PIP minimum from $10,000 to $15,000, which it did. At the same time, we employed the workers' compensation pay schedule in order to control cost on that bill. We did not realize when we did that for hospitals only, this made a significant change in how they billed. I'm not going to go into the complications of a hospital's bill, but simply put, they are now going to be getting under the bill from the last session about 75% of their bill charges of the $15,000 compared to previously getting about 100% of the $10,000. The net result was, instead of gaining money, they lost money, or at best broke even. And the goal of this was to increase their revenue. So this bill now goes back in a very simple fashion, raises up the percentage they get against the $15,000 to 90% of those billed services, which we believe will fix this bill. It will bring more money into hospitals and into the trauma centers and improve safety for Oregonians throughout the state. We should note that about 56% of all the trauma that is seen in the state is the result of automobile accidents, and that's why we use this method for trying to increase revenue for hospitals. That's about an 80,000-foot view of this. The language in the Dash 4s is the language we believe we want. There might be, and we're looking at this legally, one word to change, and that would be on line 11, a provider of hospital services may be needed to be changed to provider of inpatient hospital services, but we don't believe that's the case. We're going to look at it a little more closely. We can certainly change it on the other side if we have to. Otherwise, we'd like to have this Dash 4 moved today, if we could, into the bill and move it forward.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. And first of all, I want to thank you for working with us on the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 151. Working with Senator Bates and the hospitals over the last several days, we have come to an agreement to support the movement of the Dash 4 amendments into the bill with the proviso that Dr. Bates had just indicated. We have not had a chance to make a total determination of what this language actually does, and Mr. Barber, who's going to testify next, and I will continue a dialogue as this bill goes across the way and with Bruce Bishop, who represents the Hospital Association, to make sure that they know what it does and that we know what it does, because after the last session we concluded none of us really knew much about what it does. So we want to at least know for certain what it does and what it would do to costs, and the language and exactly what services it applies to and how that workers' comp fee schedule works and how this cost to charge ratio works is very, very complicated. So in short, we would like to use this vehicle to continue those discussions.
Thank you.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of Peace Health and Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. We were involved with the PIP bill last session. As Senator Bates and John Powell said, we ran into the problem after the session because of an interpretation by the insurance division that instead of increasing money to our trauma center, we actually lost about $1.5 million during the last year. And we were getting paid, instead of 100% of our charges, which we had been in the past, we were getting about 65% in our particular case. In negotiations with Mr. Powell and Senator Bates, John said that their goal was to try to kind of mimic what commercial health insurance pays for these services. And in our case, the biggest discount that we give from our cost to charge ratio is 90%. I mean, the biggest discount is 10%, so we end up charging 90% on the commercial side. So that's where the 90% comes in line 16. Mm-hmm. And we appreciate your willingness to take what was another bill and another issue, kind of fold it into this since it's related on the PIP side, and get this moving.
Thank you. Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question I have is, Who's taking a dollar out of whose pocket and putting it in which other pocket? I want to know how the dollars. I mean, who's winning and who's losing? Show me how the flow of the money works.
Show me the money.
Well, you want to take that? The winner we want to be is the hospital and trauma centers, because that's where the need is. A significant amount of money in PIP insurance flows to outpatient services, Sometimes as much as 40% to 50% of the entire fund flows to outpatient services, and the people are the most needy, the ones who are at greatest risk for injury, the ones in the hospital, don't get enough reimbursement. Admittedly, $15,000 doesn't cover most of the major hospitalizations, but it covers a great deal more, and private insurance picks up after $15,000, or the individual has to pick it up. And we know what that kind of a problem leads to. So the winners, and it was designed this way, the winners were to be hospitals and trauma centers. Losers would be guys like me out there treating patients. But the fee schedule that we accepted is the workman's comp schedule, which is one of the better schedules. It's close to commercial rates. It's not quite as high as we got before, but it's close to commercial rates. And it's much better than Medicare and Medicaid. So it's something that the out providers, people outside the hospital, have accepted, and I don't think there's been much argument from them on this. But it's probably taking a little bit of the outside, but puts more back into the hospitals.
And the question to John is this going to raise insurance rates?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, Mr. Chairman, and Senator, I think it's important that the Senator just described what happens to the money after it's collected, but it has to be collected first, and all of this money comes from consumers of automobile insurance. Oregon is one of only 14 states that has a comprehensive PIP mandatory benefit like this. Even in Washington State, where they have it, it's a mandatory offer that the consumer can turn it down if they cannot afford it or choose not to have it. As Senator Bates said earlier, we were concerned about the cost impact on the PIP coverages by expanding the minimum limits. Many people carry higher limits, and you should carry higher limits. And a bill that comes up later, if I have a chance to testify, I'll tell you why you should vote against it, because you can protect yourself with those higher limits. I know you're not supposed to do that, I just did. The other thing, Mr. Chair and Senator, is that's why I had the caveat I did when I testified. I don't have numbers yet. And we can't develop those numbers until we know, and Doug and I talked about this out in front of the Senate chambers, exactly what charges the cost to ratio applies to and that sort of thing. So that's why I gave that caveat, is we want to look at that so we'll know what's going to happen and how much money is going to come out of the consumer's pocket. We know more is through auto insurance. We just can't tell you today how much.
May I follow up with that, too? The last time that the PIP was raised was the 1970s. So this is a $5,000 change, very small amount when you consider what the change would be if you brought that $10,000 forward from the 1970s.
Just Doug Barber again to follow up on that. When PIP insurance was paying 100% of charges, then we switched to the higher rate, but in our case 65% of charges. What that meant was that there was a cost shift, and that cost shift is onto commercial health insurance, because that's the only place that we have to shift. And so if we can move, that's why the 90% makes sense, we think. If we can move to that, then we avoid that kind of cost shift. And auto insurance PIP coverage would be paying its own way.
Thank you.
I understand. See, this is, if you would please, if you bear with me, the goal of this bill is to protect our trauma centers. I, as an Oregonian, would rather make a little less money in my office and know that if I have a bad accident, I've got a trauma center there for me. And so it's good public policy to do this. There are, as Senator Starr pointed out, there's going to be a loser here, and I'm one of those losers. I'm willing to lose because as an Oregonian, I gain. It's really important we maintain our trauma centers, and we are losing them.
Okay, that is, we're talking about the amendments, the Dash 4 amendments. I would like just briefly to go back to the Dash 2, which the intent would be to put both of these in. The Dash 2 goes back to our original discussion 2 months ago. We have a couple of changes, and John, if you could just remind the committee of those changes.
Mr. Chair, could I be excused? I'm
yes.
Not involved.
Senator, you may be excused.
And since he jumped to the bill, I'm going to jump to another bill. Thank you for passing the PAIR bill. Saturday morning, I'm going to go to the Pear Blossom Festival in Medford, and we appreciate your work.
Well, thank you, Senator Bates and Senator Atkinson, for being sponsors of that bill. Thank you.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, on that bill, I might just say that if there's going to be a picture of a pear, I think in about 5 years, just a picture of Jack Monroe on the stamp would
come. I haven't said that.
I hope he's happy. Mr. Chairman, the amendment, the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 151 raised some of the internal PIP benefits. Most notably, the funeral benefit goes from $2,500 to $5,000. The child daycare goes from $15 per day to $25 a day with a maximum of $750. The current maximum is $450. Added to the statute is a section on page 2 of the amendments that state that the replacement work, currently you can get reimbursement under PIP for basically household chores that the person who's injured normally does. This clarifies that section, that it's if you go out and hire somebody to do those as opposed to your husband or your wife or somebody in the family. Because in many cases, there is a question about that. If the injured party normally does the dishes and you want to hire somebody to come in, if you actually hire somebody to come in, that would be covered under this provision, if you're out money. And also on the last page of the amendment, there is a section that deals with potential fraud. This section of the law did not have a fraud statement into it. It has a high standard. You have to prove that somebody willfully concealed or misrepresented a material fact in a claim.
Thank you, Mr. Powell. And these were the issues that the stakeholders had agreed on. Other issues we couldn't get there this session, but we appreciate your work on those areas. Discussion of this of the witnesses on either Dash 2s or the Dash 4 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, sir.
We do have a Dash 5 that includes the word inpatient hospital. I don't know if we want to. I think that's the only change between the Dash 4 and the Dash 5.
Well, go ahead, Mr. Chairman. Senator Starr. I had the Dash 5s prepared because we wanted the inpatient word added in the first line up above, but council inadvertently added it again down below, and again, that's one of the areas we need to continue to talk about.
So it's just how this works.
So Dash 4s is what we agreed to.
And I trust we'll continue to make sure that is clarified as we move through.
Okay.
Are we in a work session?
Yes, we are, Senator.
Move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 151.
Senator Starr, move the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 151. Discussion? Objection? Short.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 151.
Senator Starr, move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 151. Discussion? Objection? To order.
Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 151 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 151 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Senator Starr.
I just think we need to be real cautious. I'm going to support doing this. But the overriding concern I have as we deal in this issue is the number of uninsured motorists that we have out on our road today. And when you have little tweaks like this, what it means is you're going to have consumers that are going to pay higher insurance rates. And hopefully it doesn't, but I'm afraid it will translate into more uninsured motorists on our roads, and that's a concern that I think we need to continue to focus on and address. So I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you, Senator. Other discussion? Any objection? To order. Anybody in particular would like to carry this bill?
Bates.
Okay, good idea. Senator Bates. We'll carry the bill. We're pretty good at this committee of getting bills done for people. Okay. Now we are going to move on, committee, to a work session on, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Senate Bill 408. And I'm going to ask that Benjamin Westland and Michael Mason come forward. Yes. 408, colleagues, we have amendments before us which gut and stuff Senate Bill 408, so the original bill is not in play here, and Senator Westland will kick off what we now have before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Ben Westland, District 27, I am here to humbly ask your distinguished committee to consider the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 408. I sought the dash threes because I believe very sincerely that it is the best way our state can serve Oregonians in rural areas in working closely with our Native American partners to address a very important issue facing Oregon. The conditions of our forest in Central Oregon are that pressing issue and one that will become, and I give full credit to Michael Mason for this phrase, one that will become a hotly burning issue if not addressed very soon. Threat of wildfires is just not a concern to my constituents. It is a terror that they live with every summer. And if I can editorialize just a wee bit, if it was not for the dab of Weyerhaeuser-managed timber that was between Black Butte and the Cache Mountain fire 3 years ago, Black Butte would be much blacker today. We would have lost the whole resort. Anyway, for decades, first with the leadership of Representative Bikatia, then Senator, then Governor Atiyah, our relations with the Native American people of Oregon have been some of the very finest in the nation. That good work has only strengthened the tribes and their neighbors. The Warm Springs tribes have been incredible partners in progress with other communities in Central Oregon. They are expanding this partnership by embarking on a solution to our fuel-choked forest that will generate power while reducing the risk of catastrophic wildfires. Amending Senate Bill 408 to allow the PUC with a willing utility company to take into account the benefit of not having to fight these fires is the least we can do to not only help the tribes, but also help all of us solve the forest fuels crisis facing not just Central Oregon, but many parts of Oregon. This should be an absolute no-brainer when it comes to the president and leaders throughout Oregon that are urgently seeking solutions. This is just not a state of Oregon issue, but this is a state of Oregon solution that we are proposing. The Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs have demonstrated and a long and proven management history to manage the biomass project work, and if I go so far, they could probably do it without this bill, but this bill would certainly help in that cause. I would strongly urge the committee to adopt the dash threes and give the bill a due pass recommendation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Senator, why don't we go ahead and proceed with our other witnesses.
Thank you, Chair Metzger. Members of the Business and Economic Development Committee, Michael Mason, lobbyist for the Confederate Tribes of the Warm Springs. I'm here today mainly to introduce to you Larry Potts, the general manager of Warm Springs Forest Products Industries, the mill that's been running over at Warm Springs for many years now. And he has some comments to make in support of these amendments. I wanted to thank you for your consideration. I know your schedule is very hectic, but this is an important issue, as the senator has pointed out. So I turn it over to Mr. Potts.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. Over the past decade, tribal forests adjoining national forests and the Bureau of Land Management lands have been subjected to repeated catastrophic wildfires, many of which have originated in federally managed forests. There is now widespread public recognition and acceptance that a new management regime is necessary to protect Oregon's forest ecosystems, regardless of the ownership and over the long term. The tribe is uniquely situated to develop a new approach to fuel reduction, one that is sustainable without substantial government funding. First, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs, their own business enterprises, are currently generating power, manufacturing lumber, and are actively involved with managing forest lands on the Warm Springs Reservation, thus demonstrating all the skills necessary to carry out this new approach. Second, the tribes, whose professional management of its own extensive forest have earned Forest Stewardship Council certification as a green forest manager, has the necessary credibility to be entrusted with the long-term forest fuel reduction and forest health remediation efforts on public lands. Our project has the following benefits: long-term improvement of forest health in the most vulnerable stands, treatment of hazardous fuels immediately adjacent to rural communities at risk from catastrophic wildfire, improved air quality due to the net reduction in open burning and a reduction in air emissions from wildfire. Utilization of urban wood waste will reduce the amount of waste deposited in landfills, thus extending the useful life of the municipal landfills. Improved forest health will help to assure continued or enhanced public benefits derived from forest ecosystems such as watershed health, water yields, water quality, wildlife and fish habitat, and recreational opportunities. Our project will produce renewable electrical energy. Our project will demonstrate a net reduction in greenhouse gas carbon emissions resulting from cleaner burning of fuel and offsetting thermal plants which produce greater volumes of greenhouse gases, and approximately 60 to 70 new living wage jobs in an economically depressed area. Warm Springs Forest Products Industries is collaborating with groups supporting reduction of hazardous forest fuels in Central Oregon. These groups involve the tribes, agencies, conservation groups, local citizenry, and industry on issues and projects focused on developing solutions for hazardous forest fuels. Warm Springs Forest Products is participating in the Metolius Scoop Pilot Stewardship Project, the Prineville Collaborative, and the Business Alliance for Sustainable Energy. Of note is the Coordinated Resource Offering Protocol, or we call it CROP. CROP is an effort by the Forest Service, BLM, state agencies, conservation groups, and Warm Springs Forest Products to develop protocols for offering small diameter trees and biomass in a stable, even flow manner so as to stimulate investment in industries that can utilize material from hazardous forest fuels reduction projects. CROP is designated as an Oregon Solutions Project by Governor Kulongoski, and the Warm Springs Forest Products project has been selected as a pilot to demonstrate the protocols. We are in the process of finishing an initial feasibility study of the project under a $195,000 grant from the BIA. We are hopeful that we can develop sufficient revenues from a variety of sources that we are able to enter into a long-term power sale contract at market prices with a public or private utility for the sale of the electrical output of the project. Production tax credits, business energy tax credits, renewable energy credits, grants from the Energy Trust of Oregon, low-interest loans from the Oregon Department of Energy and USDA, and carbon offset credits are some of the ways in which we hope to supplement project income. Number three amendments allows us some flexibility in the event that we cannot bring the project in or at below current market rates by allowing the Public Utilities Commission to direct utilities to incorporate above market pricing for a biomass demonstration project into the utility rate base. We believe that this is appropriate for two reasons. First, this biomass project is unlike any other renewable energy project in that it provides numerous public benefits to the citizens of Oregon, including the protection of the state's forest. Finding a sustainable way of carrying out fuel reduction in our forest while creating new living wage jobs is important for all Oregonians. This model is sustainable, not requiring significant federal or state appropriations. Secondly, the two utilities likely to purchase the power will be recipients of an additional major project benefit. Both PGE and PacifiCorp have very important hydroelectric generation assets. Healthy forests are a key to healthy hydroelectric systems. Without intact fire-resilient forests, water quality, water quantity, and timing of water delivery are very much at risk. Finally, the Warm Springs project is a market approach. We believe it is sustainable. We believe that the lessons we learn in developing stewardship contracts, marketing renewable energy and carbon credits, developing power sales contracts, engaging both public and private forest owners, tapping other federal and state programs, and other aspects will be usable by many other forest managers and energy developers. What is very important now is that one significant project be put together so Oregon citizens can see firsthand that there is a sustainable, environmentally beneficial economic means of dealing with Oregon's wildfire crisis. Thank you.
Thank you. And I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I think your points are very well taken, and I think it also allows an opportunity through this demonstration project to, as the Senator pointed out, to address issues that we're concerned about with forest health and the forest fires, while creating a good out of that, and perhaps a demonstration project that, upon successful operation, can help find other solutions for other forests and other agencies that may want to adopt this this methodology to solve a lot of problems. So I appreciate it very much, and I. And I'm grateful that I had a bill that you could hijack from me, because I've been having so much fun hijacking everybody else's. So.
Well, we were going to point out, Mr. Chair, that we do notice the name at the top of the bill, and we are very appreciative for your...
I was welcome to let you have it. Questions for the committee? Senator Montes Anderson.
Yeah. The problem, I like the general idea, except you are going to be able to sell... electricity above market value, and I have an issue with that, because when you're able to sell, and who knows how this will grow, if you're going to be able to sell above market value to cover your costs, that in a sense is going to raise rates, and as far as I'm concerned, raise consumer rates. So that's the one issue I have with it.
Would you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, 2 points. It's a may, and the PUC has to approve the rates, and you have to have a willing utility to buy the power. So market forces are at work here. And I note that there are many subsidized green power efforts throughout the state, and I would submit that this falls into no different category than any of those, and that we are talking about a de minimis amount of power production. I think it's 5 to 20 megawatts. Is that right?
Yes. That's right.
That, I mean, you put that in the entire grid, and, well, it's a de minimis amount.
You couldn't find it.
I understand your concern. I wish that gas was $1.50, not $2.50, but in a commodity-driven market, which electricity, fortunately, is not in the Pacific Northwest. I think that your concern, I understand. I don't think it's impactful at all.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Anderson, there is anecdotal information that states that the public benefit of treating hazardous fuels and converting that into a saleable product far outweighs the cost of doing this. But it's all anecdotal. There has not been any firm quantification of this public benefit. That is one of the aspects that we want to accomplish in our pilot demonstration, is being able to quantify what the public benefit is of going out and doing the fuels treatment, investment in local communities, creating the family wage jobs, the collaboration which between all of the entities may not have a monetary value, but it does have a very strong social value. So we believe that with this pilot demonstration that we would have the opportunity to quantify that public benefit. And it could be that the public benefit is greatly over the cost of the above market piece.
Oh, just follow up. No, I understand your where you're coming from on that issue, but there is the risk that the technology will be far more expensive than you had realized. And although I think Senator Russell was correct, you have to have a buyer. But if you are proceeding with development and the costs are so great and you cannot find a buyer, I just have some questions about that.
If I could make one other comment, I would submit that if this just prevents one fire, turns keeps 100-acre fire, as opposed to a 10,000 or greater acre fire. Cost to the public would be many multiple times reduced, and we haven't gotten into air quality, loss of life, loss of habitat, loss of hydroelectric generation capacity. I do not have specific cost-benefit analysis. That's one of the purposes of this project. But it has to be multiple times better than a de minimis increase in a de minimis amount of power production.
Other questions? Okay, we're in work session on Senate Bill 408 with the Dash 3 amendment.
Move the Dash 3 amendment to Senate Bill 408.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash, is it the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 408. Further discussion? Objection?
Yes, I will object.
Okay, so note Senator Montes Anderson has objected. Senator Starr.
I move Senate Bill 408 as amended by the Dash 3 amendments to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 408 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection to the motion, Senator Montes Anderson?
Yes.
Any others? So moved, and Senator Westland, would you carry the bill, please?
I would be honored. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir. Okay.
Thank you.
Just, we've talked to a number of folks, but I may have made an error in convincing, telling everybody. So I want you to know there are some bills. These?
Bills 4, yes. We already know.
Okay.
600.
In case you're here for Senate Bill 12, 213, 922, or 1017, those bills will not be heard today. So I'm sorry I didn't mention that earlier. 12, 213, 922, or 1017, they will not be heard today. Okay, moving right along, committee. Where's my list again? Here's the magic list.
Magic list. So we're holding off on.
We're going to hold off on 672 for a moment. We're waiting for some things. We're ready for 209.
Okay.
Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 209. Teresa, get us up to speed here.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee member. Senate Bill 209 is brought to you by the Department of Justice. We've heard this in February and again in April, early April. It is the price gouging bill authorizing the governor to create an abnormal disruption of the market by proclamation, and then provides definitions of what that means and the definitions of what will entail as being an unlawful trade practice. You do have some amendments in front of you. I believe they're the dash ones that are consensus amendments that were made after discussions that were brought to both hearings and amongst committee members.
And who, Ms. Fenwick, would be best to walk us through that?
I think Cheryl Pellegrini is here from the department.
Oh, well, there she is. Cheryl, you're hiding back there. Come on forward. You remember we had this discussion, I think, a while back as well, colleagues. We had some questions about the scope of the determination. We had questions about the length of the governor's proclamation. We had questions about what services would be included. And so there's been a lot of discussion, and Ms. Pellegrini is going to capsulize that for us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. I'm an attorney, Assistant Attorney General with the Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. I would note for the record from the outset, Mr. Chair, that the Dash 1 amendments currently before the committee do not appear to reflect all of the revisions that were submitted by the Department of Justice to Legislative Council. And there appear to be two areas in which further revisions at least may be indicated. And they are, there is a request that contractors be removed from the bill, and the Dash 1 amendments do not accomplish that. In addition, there was a request on page 2 at subsection 6.
Please go ahead.
On page 2 at subsection 6, after conversation with Mr. Dewey, who represents a client that had concerns, the Attorney General agreed to reduce the time within which we must respond to a request from 7 business days to 4 calendar days. And that change is not reflected in the Dash 1 amendments either. But with that, I would be happy to walk you through the changes that the Dash 1 amendments do make to the original bill.
Senator Starr.
Do we have these other amendments coming?
Senator Starr, these amendments were given to me about 11:30, 11:45 this morning. So these are the first set of amendments that I've seen on this bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
You know, we've had, how long has it been since we last heard this bill? 4-7. It's today. 2-10 was the first hearing.
Yes.
I know that we've been working on this bill. I'm just curious to why we don't have amendments, and this is the last day that we're going to be supposed to be doing this bill. Is this, Mr. Chair, a bill that you are interested in carrying over past?
Well, I think what we should do, Senator Starr, with the indulgence of the committee, I'm interested in the bill, but we also recognize our workload on this at this point, and I think what we should do is, Ms. Pellegrini, see if we can get these amendments drawn, and then we'll have to kind of take an assessment of the committee whether we should bring the bill back at this point, because this is our deadline day. And
it's a little surprised we don't have the right amendments in front of us.
Yeah, the department, we submitted the language to Legislative Council on it. I don't know what else to say. It just didn't come out the way we submitted it. I don't know if the committee would want to pass or consider entertain passing the bill out with the understanding that it would be further amended in the House, if that's something that the chair is inclined to do.
I think what I would like to do, Ms. Pellegrini, because of what I know we have and a lot of issues, is that I would offer that you may draft the amendments correctly, you know, with all the correctly meaning all the different issues that were presented. And then we'll, you know, poll the committee as to whether they want to bring it back for another work session, because I would have to ask the Senate President at that point for permission to do that.
Okay.
And I'll leave that up to you to decide whether you want to do that or not.
Actually, we have them drafted. I mean, we have them drafted and they were submitted. So we have what.
Well, I don't know where the I don't know where it happened. All I know is that we don't have them. You know, I know we have talked about this and different members, and we have talked about it. My understanding was that would produce the amendment before us, and for whatever reason, and for whoever, we don't have it.
Okay.
So I think we'll close the work session at this point on this bill, Senate Bill 209. And is Mr. Nelson here?
I'll see if he's
outside. Yeah. We'll stand at ease for a second. I missed one piece of testimony, and I apologize for that.
It's frustrating.
Mark Nelson, would you please come forward? First of all, I want to apologize. Apparently Mr. Nelson had signed up to talk on Senate Bill 408, and I didn't see that. I apologize. So we're going to reopen the work session, Senate Bill 408, for the discussion by Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman,
welcome, and my apologies.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities, and I'm passing out now just a list of the membership of ICNU. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on the bill, and I'll try to be to the point. In the proposed amendments, on line 11, it says that the electric company may agree to pay for the electricity at the price necessary to make the project economically feasible. Moving on line 18, it says an electric company that purchases electricity from a qualifying forest biomass project shall include the cost of electricity in the cost used to set the rates of the electric company. Finally, on line 22, sub 4, in setting the rates of an electric company, the public utility shall allow recovery of any cost associated with the purchase of electricity under a contract subject to this section. The commission shall allow the recovery of these costs from all classes of ratepayers. We want to commend the Warm Springs Indian Tribe, their desire to combine forest fuels reduction program with a biomass generation opportunity. We don't have a problem with that. We certainly agree that they put together a package, or they're putting together a package of production tax credits, business energy tax credits, low interest loans, and perhaps support from the Energy Trust of Oregon, and we have no problem with that. We the problem is if they can't make the project economical, they want the Public Utility Commission to direct the local utility, in this case it's Pacific Corp, to incorporate the above market pricing in the utility rate base and assure the utility that it will get full cost recovery for this additional cost from ratepayers. We don't believe that any utility should pay above above market for a resource. There is a renewable program within the Energy Trust of Oregon to specifically provide for funding of above market renewables. The public utility has a process today underway, has been underway for over a year, to determine what is the appropriate cost for utility to pay for generation from a generator. This proceeding is called UM1129, is almost concluded. Industrial customers, Northwest Utility, participate extensively in this proceeding and hope to get a result that sets a fair avoided cost for generators and ratepayers. No one should get paid above the avoided costs that would be paid to other generators. I would mention that in fact Pacific Corp has a rate case right now before the PUC that would increase the base rates by 22%. Our concern is that adding additional above market costs to further increase rate making, Pacific Corp rate making, to industrial customers makes us far less competitive. Even though that this is billed as a pilot program, and again, we would support the program. It opens the door to further attempts to impose higher costs on electric utilities, either PGE or Pacific Corp. If there's a broad social benefit to this project, beyond one that could be supported by avoided costs and other state programs like the Energy Trust, then the state as a whole should share in the cost, not just a limited set of utility customers. Again, we have no problem with the project. We just have a problem with shifting those costs onto, in our case, industrial users, and I'm certainly sure that that CUB on the residential side, and I know AOI from the commercial side, has the same concern. So again, we laud the project. We just don't believe that you should mandate that, one, that it shall, the utility shall accept it, and two, that the commission shall put it into the rate base.
Well, Mr. Nelson, thank you for your comments, and as you heard, obviously, in the other testimony, this is, of course, a pilot project. It's limited to the tribe, it's limited to tribal land, it's limited to projects between 5 and 20 megawatts. But I think, you know, you've made some valid points, Senator Monis Anderson echoed some of those thoughts, and of course, our proponents are gone. And what I would suggest, and as I'm sure you will, is continue to track that issue as it moves through the process and see if there is any other changes that you might be able to get from it.
Mr. Chair, we would be happy to work with the proponents on adjusting some of their language, but the mandatory nature of these amendments means that we have to oppose very strongly the entire bill.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. This is one of those days. So let me just. Where are we going to go next? We're going to go to 210. Are we ready with 210?
We are ready with 210. Yes.
We got amendments. The
yes.
Members have amendments
yes.
passed out. Okay. We're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 210. And Teresa, would you kind of help kind of focus where we are?
Yes. The Senate Bill 210, Mr. Chair, committee members, requires motor vehicle repair shops to display sign disclosing preferred provider agreement with a motor insurance insurer. We heard this bill on March 17th. You have two sets of amendments in front of you, the Dash 2 amendments, which were provided by Senator Metzger, which rewords the verbiage on the required sign, and you also have a Dash 4 amendment from Sean Miller, which changes some of the provisions of the bill.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Starr.
You want to remove the Dash 4s and the Dash...
Yes, I think what we should do, though, first is have Mr. Miller come forward on the Dash 4s. Just a reminder, committee, we had heard this bill in committee on the auto shops. We were kind of having a dispute over wordsmithing a sign, so the committee kind of wordsmithed our own sign. That is the Dash 2. And then Mr. Miller presented another interesting signage opportunity and would like to present that. So please, go ahead. In relation now to the dashboards.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Miller has asked me to briefly go over the Dash 4 amendments for you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this, in terms of giving consumer notices, we were discussing several concepts, including the language that the committee is considering in the Dash 2 amendments, and bring for your consideration the Dash 4s, which would require in cases where a automotive repair shop has multiple complaints filed with the Attorney General, that notice would also be given to the consumer by signage, and a copy of complaints listed by the Attorney General be provided upon demand by the consumer. Again, we think in terms of fair disclosure to consumers that this kind of an amendment would make sense.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I represent the Property Casualty Insurers Association, and I would concur with John on the Dash 4 amendments. We've had discussions when we received the complaint list from the Attorney General's office. We think if this is going to be a consumer protection notice bill, that this should be a part of that bill. I think they're okay with the bill, and as we've also discussed this with the Trial Lawyers Association, they're okay with the bill or the amendment, the Dash 4s, and we would urge the committee to adopt the Dash 4s.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Well, I was intrigued when this was presented, certainly as we were talking about this. Part of this is an assumption that if you have a preferred provider agreement that you're doing a bad job, and that may or may not necessarily be the case. So I think it would be fair if there were multiple complaints that would be a fair balance to protect the consumer. Mr. Neely from the Attorney General's office, they were speaking for you. I would just like to see if you say the same thing.
Mr. Chair, I think the first time ever with these two guys, I will agree with them.
No,
I wasn't even in the room to hear what they said. Now, I for the record, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers. We have, in fact, looked at both the amendments in front of you, and I don't think our office has any concerns with either of those amendments. Again, our bottom line is to get as much information in front of consumers as possible. Both these amendments appear to do so. I do think that the amendment, the Dash 3 amendments, will cost a little bit of money for the Department of Justice, and we haven't had a time to analyze that, but I don't think that it will be all that expensive.
Okay. And we're doing the Dash 4, but I think it's
sorry, the Dash 4.
Yes. Okay. For a question from the committee.
I can't.
Yes, you can.
Yes.
And you will, I'm sure.
First of all, the Dash 4s. It says complaints about this repair shop have been received by the Attorney General. Details are available upon request. I can't imagine a company wanting to post that they have received complaints. And second of all, I think this bill is really unnecessary, totally. This is an industry that is unlicensed, and if we're going to take care of the problem, we should have a licensing, where there's actually investigative work and really address the issue. A sign in a shop is not going to take care of the quality of service that's being provided. End of story.
Really, you want to respond?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moss Anderson, I think, again, at the outset, our concern is that consumers have the opportunity to understand that there are, in fact, arrangements that are made between insurance companies and between collision centers that may, in fact, lead to services on their vehicle that they weren't aware of, or a level of service that they weren't aware of, and that they ought to have the opportunity to understand the terms of that agreement if possible. Again, here they may well ask the question, is it possible for me to take a look at that agreement? And the answer, presuming you adopt the Dash 2 amendments, would be, yeah, we can take a look at the agreement, understand what's going to happen to our vehicle. It's just simply a question of, can we get as much information as possible?
And just a statement. as a health provider, we make referrals all of the time to various specific doctors, et cetera. I mean, referrals is just a general practice in many professions. And I don't see anything wrong with an insurance company referring clients to a certain auto body shop. It's a relationship. They know the quality. And since a very good friend of mine does have an auto body shop, and does have an insurance company that they get referrals from, they don't get any kickbacks, and the quality of work is done because of the owner and his control over the people who are actually performing the work. So it just seems just not reasonable to require a sign.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
All right. We'll bring this back in a few minutes. We're going to move ahead, though, right now. Let's see, 211. Close the work session for the moment on Senate Bill 210 and open work session on Senate Bill 211.
I'm going to put that in the first few minutes.
Again, let's see, this is our Attorney General under securities law, and our representative on that bill with the dash one is?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Fred Boss. I am Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'd be pleased to address the dash one and the dash two amendments.
Okay. Please proceed.
This Senate Bill 211 does give the Attorney General authority to prosecute the securities laws of the state of Oregon. The dash one amendments narrows that authority to two specific areas. Number one, the federally covered securities, and number two, areas in which the Attorney General is already investigating a matter under his authority under the UTPA, RICO, or the antitrust statutes. The dash two amendments further narrows the scope of the Attorney General's authority to prosecute the Oregon securities laws to those from federally covered securities to those securities that are listed on the three national exchanges, the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, or the NASDAQ.
Mm-hmm. Okay, questions? I'm looking for the dash two here. Here we are. Here's the dash two. Senate Bill 211. And again, does this encompass, does the dash two encompass the dash one then? It appears to do that.
Sure, Mr. Heat, correct.
Okay. They do. All right. Anyway, again, any other questions on the dash two amendments? Okay, well, we're in a work session on 211.
Move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 211.
Senator Scars, move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 211. Discussion? Objection? Orders.
And this goes to the floor, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, yes.
Move the Senate Bill 211 as amended to the Senate floor to be passed.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 211 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Further discussion? Further objection? It's ordered. I'll carry that bill. Okay. Well, no. Now, let's proceed ahead here to Senate Bill 213. Right? Is that correct?
Actually,
212. I got a hand to get filled in before I go back.
Laura and I are now.
Which one? We have that one?
Yeah, we don't.
Oh, okay.
Auto bill.
Okay, we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 212. And if you want to remind me of this one.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Committee Member Senate Bill 2 calls from the Department of Justice. It makes unlawful debt collection practices and unlawful trade practice enforceable by the Attorney General. There are no amendments in front of you.
Okay. Ms. Pellegrini, would you come forward just for a moment and refresh the committee? We heard this bill a couple of months ago, and we had, as I recall, three or four consumers who had testified about being harassed unlawfully for debt collection.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice, Assistant Attorney General for Fraud, Consumer Protection. Yes, Mr. Chair, there were three consumers who testified that they had been subject to practices which are currently prohibited under the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act. That act is found at ORS 646639. What this bill would do is that it would give the Attorney General the authority to pursue violations of the State Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act as an unconscionable practice under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It does not create an additional private right of action. I would note for the record, and I'm hoping that that the Federal Trade Commission Charles Harwood letter received, you received that?
Did you receive it?
If you can, I made copies.
Please.
Approach. There was an issue raised by the Third Party Debt Collectors Association that this bill may create a situation where that industry was subject to dual enforcement.
It's okay.
And the committee sought some statement from the Federal Trade Commission about its perspective on the extent to which state enforcement, or the extent to which attorneys general had a role to play in the enforcement of State Debt Collection Practices Act, given that there was a federal act enforceable by the FTC. Charles Harwood, who is the regional director of the Federal Trade Commission, wrote a letter and that is currently being circulated to all of you that sets out the role that the attorneys general do in fact play with regard to unlawful debt collection. And if I can just highlight that. The Federal Trade Commission letter makes clear that federal law does not preempt state law, and in fact it is specifically doesn't preempt state law where state law is more protective. It states that the FTC looks to states to share the enforcement responsibility in the area of Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and that especially exchanging information facilitates discussion. When state enforcement agencies have authority similar to that exercised by the Federal Trade Commission, the Federal Trade Commission seeks to ensure its efforts do not duplicate those of the state. Exchanging information facilitates discussion between FTC staff and state agencies about whether a particular matter is best handled by the FTC or at the local level. So in other words, the FTC is confirming what we represented, which is that we work together and determine which agency is more appropriately positioned to take action against a particular collector. So that's what this letter does. The second thing is that I was informed by Mr. Harwood there was a concern I think raised about this maybe isn't a problem that has risen to the level where it warrants Attorney General enforcement authority. And I would note, just for the record, that the Federal Trade Commission every year puts out an annual report. They are about to put out their annual report for 2005, but I have the annual report for 2004, and it reports on complaint statistics received during the year 2003. And that report states that the Commission received more complaints in 2003 about third-party debt collectors, 34,543, than about any other specific industry. That, together with the statistics that have been compiled by the Department of Justice, and remember our state law covers collection agencies, plus what we call first-party collectors, creditors that collect on their own behalf, and that they had risen to number five. So that's what, essentially, that's what you now have before you.
Okay. Any questions, Ms. Pellegrini, before we move ahead? Thank you, and thanks for clearing, asking that question that was brought up in testimony from Mr. Harwood from the FTC.
You're very welcome.
We're in work session. We have no amendments to Senate Bill 212.
I move Senate Bill 212 to the Senate floor with pass recommendation.
Senator Starrs moves Senate Bill 212 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? Senator Atkinson. All right. Passes. Anybody like to carry this good piece of consumer legislation? All right. I will carry. All right. We're going to go back to Senate. We're going to reopen the work session, Senate Bill 210. We were discussing, members, a Dash 4 and a Dash 2 amendment. The chair would entertain a motion on the Dash 2 amendment. Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 210. Further discussion on that amendment? Any objection to that amendment?
Yes.
Senator Monis Anderson. Anyone else? So moved. Who would like to carry this bill?
No, we have to move that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. You're right. The amendment. Now, that's what happens when we get 9 million things on the agenda. So, we have Senate Bill 210 as amended now. Recommended to the floor of the UCAS recommendation. Discussion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Atkinson.
I would support this bill if it were put into the force feeding of ducks bill. Otherwise, I can't believe this is an issue bill for me.
Okay.
I will be opposing it.
All right. Further discussion.
Is it possible to put it in the force feeding of ducks bill?
If it was a conceptual Senate concurrent resolution, we could do it.
We'll pursue that as it moves to the House. How's that? Further discussion? Further objections? I believe, Senator Monis Anderson and Senator Atkinson. Yes. All right. So ordered. Chair will carry. All right. Now, we rock and roll here. Where are we at now?
9:07.
Okay. Open up work session, Senate Bill 997. Go ahead, Ms. Van Winkle.
Okay.
If I find it in my large stack of bills.
Senate Bill 997 is a committee bill's rule on behalf of the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. It authorizes vehicle dealers to charge a processing fee for collecting fees and completing and submitting documents to transfer the certificate of title and registration. It also allows the dealer to charge a processing fee to complete the documents if the vehicles can be titled in another jurisdiction. You have in front of you Dash 3 amendments from the auto dealers, which hammers out some concerns between the auto dealers and the Department of Justice. We both have Daryl Fuller and Cheryl Pilgrim.
And that's
today.
Asked them please to come forward to discuss the Dash 3 amendments to this bill. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller. I represent the Oregon Auto Dealers Association. As I was walking up, I asked Cheryl, are you okay with these? Because we just got them before the hearing, and it looks like we're both okay. When you had the public hearing on this bill, we testified to the agreement that we had with the Department of Justice that required amendments that replaced the original bill. The amendments that you have before us meet with the agreement that we put together with the Attorney General's Office. And what it does is essentially two things. It allows auto dealers to process the paperwork to complete the title and registration work for our customers, for all of our customers, and to charge a fee for that is set in statute or by rule. It also caps a fee that is currently not capped in statute if a customer chooses to allow the dealer to submit that information electronically. Well, we can add an additional fee for that electronic filing. Right now, that fee is set by the dealership and cannot be capped by statute, and this caps it at an additional $25.
Okay. Remember, we did previously discuss that, so we have the cap 75, the cap some 50. Comments from the Department of Justice. And
thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice. The only other point I would make, Mr. Chair, is that the way that we envision this to work is that dealers can now elect to do paperwork either by the electronically or by submitting the paper copies. And if they choose to do that, the buyer gets to choose which processing method they will use and which fee the buyer will pay. So that's how we envision this working. Whereas before, there was an option for a buyer to do their own paperwork. Here, if the dealer elects to do it, they may make that election, but the buyer gets to decide which process and method they'll be used and which fee they'll pay.
Thank you. Yes.
So I must have missed it. It's $35 then to do paper, and then how much for, to file electronically?
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, it's actually for paper filing, it's $50. And for electronic vehicle registration, that's where you get your plates issued by the dealer as well on the spot, it's $75.
And now it is?
It's 50 and 75.
Still now?
Yeah, it's capped. It will be capped at that by an agreement of the association, and it will be capped via a rule that will, is to be promulgated by the Department of Motor Vehicles.
Mr. Chair, Senator Montes-Anderson, the difference in what you're questioning about right now is there's a statute that says when we do the electronic vehicle registration that the state cannot establish what that fee is. Dealers can charge any amount they want for that because it's an option we're selling to the customer. We're agreeing to cap that fee at an additional $25 rather than letting it be whatever the customer and the dealer negotiate. So it establishes an industry standards so that we don't have people all over the map on what they're charging for the same service.
I understand now. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay, so we're dash three amendments on Senate Bill 997.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the dash three amendments.
Senator Starr has moved the dash three amendments, Senate Bill 997. Discussion? The objection to the motion? So ordered. Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 997 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Let's see. Who should carry this bill? Well,
okay.
Senator Starr will carry the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Now, let's see. This one is not going to be heard. 949. Okay, we're opening up a work session on Senate Bill 949.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 949 is from the Judiciary Committee. It establishes requirements for motor vehicle liability arbitration proceedings. You do have a dash two amendments in front of you, and Neil Jackson from the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, Steve Morrell, I believe are both here to testify on the amendments.
Please, if you would come forward. Members, we heard these a few weeks ago, and there were some points that we felt were resolvable, and we asked them to work on that, and at least in some cases that has apparently been successful. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman,
if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm on the Board of Governors of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Just to refresh the committee's memory, Senate Bill 949 basically sets the method by which disputes between insurance companies and their insureds will resolve these disputes in arbitration. They apply to personal injury protection disputes, uninsured motorist disputes, and underinsured motorist disputes. Basically, what it does is mandates a three-panel arbitration proceeding, use of local court rules in these proceedings, and makes it so that these proceedings will not be used subsequently in a proceeding different or not involved in the issues that are arbitrated between the insured and their insurance company. Simply put, what that means is you got a dispute with your insurer, you resolve it under this arbitration procedure. If subsequently there is a lawsuit, you can't go back to what was done at that arbitration procedure between the insurer and their own company and use whatever decision was there. The purpose for that is, Mr. Merle and I agree that the issues in these disputes between the insured and their own company are most times different from the issues that happen in subsequent litigation. And that's basically what we're trying to do. Mr. Merle and I were talking about the dash two amendments. I believe we agree we would ask the committee to go ahead and adopt them and adopt the bill and send it to the floor. We acknowledge that we need to work a little bit tweaking the language in subsection 2 of the dash 2 amendments to make it crystal clear exactly what the intent is in these proceedings.
Mr. Merle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Merle. I'm an attorney employed by the Claim Department of State Farm. I think Mr. Jackson has put it very accurately. We feel like there are some technical issues. I think conceptually we've reached an agreement on this. That it basically is what the Dash 2 amendments will do is it allows parties to have choices. If we decide it's reasonable to use one arbitrator versus three, or if we decide to use a different set of rules other than the Uniform Trial Court rules because that case suits it, party agreement allows to do that. The default is going back to three-panel arbitration and to the use of the Uniform Trial Court rules if you can't agree. Mr. Jackson described, I think, what our intent in subsection 2 is, but I think there's some technical reworking of that section to affect that intent.
Now, my question to the two of you on this, first of all, are you, the two of you, comfortable with your work product to move this forward in this stage based on...
Yeah. Senator Messer, yes, we are.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. We have a Dash 2 amendment on Senate Bill 949.
Move the Dash 2 amendment.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 949. Discussion? Objection? Order. Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 949 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Who would like to carry this bill? Senator Deckert, would you carry that bill? Thank you very much. Okay, I see. Do we have... is everybody here, Mr. Carlson? Okay. And we'll wait a few moments. Then let's go ahead to opening up a work session on Senate Bill 950. Teresa?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee member. Senate Bill 950 is also another Judiciary Committee bill. Revises motor vehicle liability insurance laws regarding how an insurance carrier recovers amounts paid for an personal injury protection claim. You have in front of you Dash 2 amendments, yet again, from the same people that were here for on Senate Bill 949.
So please return.
What bill are we on?
950. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, for the record, I'm Steve Merle, an attorney appellate for the Claim Department of State Farm Insurance. This is one of two bills that you've heard before and that the trial lawyers and I were able to reach conceptually an agreement on. The concern in that was raised with the original bill and the original testimony was that in some cases the trial lawyers have experienced problems where insurers have not elected methods that they have available under the statutes to recover their PIP interest. That was resulting in sometimes the attorney actually doing the litigation, recovering the insurer's interest, and then disbursing to his client, only to have the insurer come back and say to the client they wanted to be paid in full if they were entitled to under the statutes, and to not share in the attorney fee or the costs. My thought was that current law did that for them, although Mr. Jackson was able to convince me there is some wiggle room in the sets of statute that deal with recovery of PIP benefits that a carrier pays. The Dash 2 mem before you reworks the three statutes that provide for recovery of PIP benefits that a carrier pays. The first one, 534, is direct reimbursement between insurers. 536 is the assertion of a lien, and 538 is what we call subrogation, which is where you haven't done either one of the first two methods or they're not available to you. We've reworked the language considerably to make it clear that the only time an insurance carrier is going to not incur their proportionate share of fees and expenses in recovering their PIP benefits is when they do it direct from another insurer. I convince the other insurer, if it's Allstate, to pay me back directly. In that case, the insurance carrier does not owe any fees or expenses. If they assert a lien or use any other method, if the insured incurred expenses to affect that recovery, they share in those expenses and fees in proportion to what their interest was and what the entire recovery is. The Dash 2 amendments were just given to us prior to the committee meeting. We're looking at them. We feel like conceptually that we have agreement and it will. We've got the idea of what we need to do, being aware that there may be some technical issues that we need to work out and tweak so that it affects just what I explained to you happening.
Thank you, Mr. Earle. Questions from the committee? This is Again, I appreciate your work on this, especially the understanding of clarifying what we're essentially trying to do, clarifying law and clarifying standard practice, at least with most of the insurers. I guess I would ask the same question because you do want to review for, you know, technical errors. Do you have any discomfort in moving the bill forward at this time without those being done?
Senator Mexer, I don't. I think that we have an agreement with the trial lawyers. We both have some issues that may be technical, and I think the wider circulation we got, the better bill we'll have in the end, but I think those can be worked out with the bill going forward today.
Okay. So we have a dash to amendment, members, on Senate Bill 950. Is everyone comfortable with those who are in the room, since we're limited at the moment? Then I would entertain a motion to take the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 950.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 950.
Senator Decker has moved the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 950. Further discussion? Any objection to that motion? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Decker.
I move Senate Bill 950 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Decker has moved Senate Bill 950 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Objection? So ordered. Anybody in particular would like to carry that bill? All right. I'll carry it. Okay. Now, let's see. Mr. Carlson, are we ready? Okay, what we're going to do, members, we're going to go back up. We're going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 672. And let me get my... I've got so much paper here, I just cannot find anything. But, Mr. Carlson, I know I want you up here. Mr. Robbins and Mr. Vial. Members, this bill actually, or at least parts of this bill, originated almost a year ago in discussions with some constituents in my district regarding their homeowners association and some issues they had. And we've been developing 672 on that basis. Since that time, other individuals who, you know, represent other issues have also been interested in making some adjustments to that to those provisions. What we're going to do today, and this will not be a long public hearing on this, because I think we will bring this back because this bill is too complicated at the moment for a thorough airing under this particular day. But I want to kind of get the overall issues on the table, a brief analysis by Mr. Carlson of our office, because I'm particularly interested about how this affects consumers and homeowners, as to what any things that he sees in it. And then, if so inclined by the committee and the individuals interested in these statutes are willing to continue to work, then I would allow that to happen. So with that, I think I will ask Mr. Robbins to identify yourself, and if you could please maybe give us a very brief synopsis of the issues that you have faced, and what you see attempted to be done, at least from your perspective, with in working with Mr. Carlson on Senate Bill 672.
My name is Philip A. Robbins. I live at 8964 Southeast Bristol, Bristol, Park Drive, Portland, 97266, although it's in Clackamas County. Yeah. Any addition?
I would like, if you could, Mr. We have written testimony from you, and I appreciate this very much. I would, if you could give us a, you know, just kind of speak from your heart some of the issues that you have developed, understood, and what you believe there is, you know, legislative correction that needs to be made. Again, we have the written testimony and have a lot of material that we'll analyze later. But if you could just kind of tell me, what are we trying to correct and what are the issues you see out there?
Right, I had that outline.
Yes, and it is outlined here.
I made the 3 minutes.
I know, you're doing a great job. But,
version here.
But you could speak to us a little bit.
Okay, I'm actually the editor and publisher of the Mount Scott Monitor newsletter that goes out to the about 100 residents at Altamont, and also the media, 14 media people, and every member of the state legislature. I've also included here a CD which has basically three folders in there. One is every issue of the Mount Scott Monitor. One has the four resolutions, compliance resolutions, that tell what's going to happen to you if you don't obey the law and the rules and regulations of the association. The third one are some is the minutes, draft of the minutes of the last meeting, and how they're penalizing homeowners for various infractions. I have four areas I think that are very, very important. One is voting. We have only 8 people electing the Board of Representatives out of 300-plus families. And the other outline explains how that takes place. Also, the emails on the CD indicate from the developers what the rationale is for that, the philosophy that they have. I understand that this is probably the most important thing to me is the voting. I understand there's a problem in getting that done. Without a vote, if you can't elect your representatives, whether they're in this body or on the board of directors, no one's going to pay any attention to them. And it becomes just a very closed circle. I refer to it sometimes as a junior high clique. The second issue is disclosure. When we bought in Altamont in 1998, we did not get our CC&Rs and bylaws until about 3 weeks after the deal had been closed. They came, were mailed to us by Chicago Title. And so we had no idea what that was. There was some mention of an association at the time, but the Altamont was in its infancy and nobody was paying much attention to, not even the developers. It was only later on that everyone became aware of it. I think the SB 672 does a fine job on disclosure. You ask that the people who are selling homes, whether it be the developers or a real estate company, give a lot of information so people know what they're getting into. That is not the case today. And the disclosure often takes place at the end of the process when you have a stack of papers and they say initial here and sign there, and you don't know what you're initialing and signing, and they slip in the papers referencing acceptance of the CC&Rs and so on. In addition to what you have in 672, I think it's very important that that you flag advertising, particularly display advertising in real estate, so a reader or a person, a prospective buyer, realizes that a homeowner association is involved in the development they're looking at. Otherwise, an icon, just like the Equal Opportunity Housing icon or the R that indicates that the person is a realtor, if we had an icon, that the public would become educated to this and they would be aware of what they're getting into or at least know what questions to ask. Conflict resolution, this is another area that you address, and I think you're in line with a lot of other states. I know Nevada, California, and Arizona are all looking at ombudsman programs to avoid foreclosure and liens and these draconian fines that these boards are inflicting on the residents. So we need something to another mode to get away from these draconian actions. And even the people who are taking these actions realize that's what it is. I was reading an email or an article here just the other day that a lot of these people do not know what to do with that situation. Rules and regulations. We have a set of rules and regulations for both architectural concerns and, you might say, lifestyle concerns. These regulations run 31 pages. Everything from what kind of plants you can plant, how far you can plant certain plants on center. Better not listen to Mike Darcy or even Martha on that, because it's all spelled out. It's what I call over control.
Okay, Mr. Robbins, I'm going to just stop right there. And by the way, this is great with the CD and your notations. We will look at that and go through all that. I'm trying to get a flavor. And I got two major things from you, and I'm sympathetic to everything you've said. Disclosure, number one, and participation in the process. I mean, that's and we have some details, and I'm going to ask Eric to comment on some of those things. I'm going to go now to Mr. Vial to with the same amount of time to give his general overview of what he would like to accomplish and why it is important.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, Rich Vial. I'm an attorney in Portland with Vial Fotheringham. Our firm represents about 1,500 homeowner associations, both condominium and planned community, in our market area, which is the Northwest States. We are currently acting as the chair, Barbara Kahns of my office, who is the legislative liaison for our office, and myself are acting as chair of what's called the Condominium HOA Working Group, which has existed since approximately 1979 here in Oregon, comprised of a number of attorneys, managers, and consultants to the homeowner association industry. The Community Associations Institute, the national trade organization, has a liaison that sits on our group, as does the Oregon Washington Community Association Managers, or ALCAM, has two representatives on our group. We are actually thrilled to death that someone like Mr. Robbins would take the initiative and indicate interest in this issue. We believe that more interest by members of the homeowner associations that we attempt to serve is important to making positive changes to the legislation that we have currently. I want to address two things that Mr. Robbins brought up. He brought up voting. I have not reviewed Mr. Robbins' documents. I have not. I do not know about his project, but I suspect that they are very unique and that they probably deal with a master association where subordinate associations are electing the representatives to the master association. That is a Sun River type of thing, if you wanted to use a larger example. It is true that under Oregon law, in all condominiums and planned communities currently, the membership has the right to elect the board of directors, and if the documents do not state that in Mr. Robbins' case, they should definitely be subjected to correction, but I don't think it requires legislative action. With respect to disclosure, which is the most important part of what Mr. Robbins brings up, we have a lot of disclosure legislation currently in place. We have ORS Chapter 105 that is responsible for all the disclosure that the realtors have to go through. It has a substantial section on homeowner associations and planned communities. We have ORS Chapter 100, which requires the developer to make extensive disclosures at the time that condominium units are initially sold. We don't have any disclosure requirement other than ORS Chapter 105 for the non-new condo issues. But we have talked about this issue a number of times, and we believe it needs to be looked at. However, we must tell you that we believe that Senate Bill 672 is a good start, but needs significant attention. We are here today to suggest an alternative to this. We would like very much to work with Mr. Robbins and those that he is representing on a discussion about this. We believe that the best thing to do right now is to, we have another bill in Judiciary, Senate Bill 906, an extensive bill that does a lot of things to help tweak and make homeowner associations more democratic and more user-friendly. We believe that incorporating those provisions into Senate Bill 672 would be an excellent idea, and that is what the Dash 4 amendments that you have in front of you would do. The Dash 2 amendments, which you have in front of you, would take the the provisions of 672 that deal with disclosure and send them to an interim committee. For lack of a better group, we have suggested that the real estate commissioner chair that committee, and we have in the Dash 2 amendments recommended a number of constituencies to be represented, including Mr. Robbins' constituency, those that he represents. If the committee does not think the real estate commissioner is the right place to go, that was just somebody we thought would be nonpartisan, and that was why we suggested that. But we believe that a very detailed and important discussion should take place so that this disclosure problem in homeowner associations can be addressed.
Thank you, Mr. Val. What I'm going to ask to do, and again, I'm going to see if that, within the purview of our time, that they can. I mean, this is rather voluminous for today. So I've asked Mr. Carlson, who has actually been in contact on this issue for a year now, working on it, if you would, and I'm talking about just capsulize things, Mr. Carlson, give us some of the highlights of 672 as drafted with Mr. Robbins and others. Some of the points, salient points of that part of the amendments. They were drafted, the pieces that Mr. Vile said, in the judiciary also as potential information for 672. Any observations that you have on that? That would give us a background, and then I'll ask and see if either Mr. Vile's suggestion about it on an interim basis, whether there's anything that could be done during this session, and we'll make that decision. So, Mr. Carlson?
For the record, Eric Carlson, Senate Majority Office. The general theory behind Senate Bill 672 is to bring more balance to the relative positions of homeowner associations and the individual homeowners within their condos or planned communities. The homeowner associations are like any group. They're able to aggregate resources and often have more resources to apply to an issue than the individual homeowners do. So what we attempted to do in this draft, and these are all policy issues for you all to resolve, is to make the procedure somewhat more like the procedures you would find in a local government, because the homeowners association is in some sense a substitute for a local government. So very simply, Section 2 requires advanced disclosure to buyers. Section 3 specifies the contents of the disclosure notice. Section 4 gets at an issue that occurs with homeowner associations when they are turned over from the developer or declarants, as they're known legally, to the homeowners. Sometimes there will be a contract with a property management company or other company that runs long after the turnover. This provision would say that those contracts can only run for 30 days and then have to basically be renegotiated by the homeowners when they take over the association. Section 5 requires 15 days notice of board meetings, so that people know that board meetings are coming with a couple weeks notice. Section 6 requires 30 days notice, advance notice of a proposed budget, so that people know what's coming up in budget proposals for the homeowners association, and provides that if the homeowners association does not adopt an annual budget, that they cannot increase the assessments on the homeowners. And the purpose of this, again, is just to provide disclosure. Currently, the statute only provides that the association board has to provide notice within 30 days after they've taken action. And Section 7 goes at an issue that has come up in other states. I'm not sure that it's come up in Oregon, but what it does currently, the homeowner association liens are in line ahead of the homeowner exemption provided in statute. This Section 7 would make the liens in line behind the homeowner exemption so that that would protect some of the equity of homeowners. In other states, there have been problems with liens being foreclosed and the owners losing their complete equity. Mr. Chair, do the members have the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes.
Okay. The Dash 1 amendments, one section, provides notice of assessments. That is, if the Board of Directors wants to increase assessments, they have to provide 30 days notice so that everybody knows what's coming down. One of the problems with Altamont was that people got notices of increased assessment after the fact. Another section in the Dash 1 amendments provides that the bylaws expire 30 days after turnover. That's a very short period of time. The theory behind the provision is the Homeowners Association needs to look at its governing document and decide how it wants to be governed, not just automatically accept the old bylaws. 30 days may be the wrong length of time. There may be another mechanism, but it's to get the new Board of Directors to look closely at how they're going to run the association. And then Section 12 gets at another issue that's come up in other states. And it provides that agents of the Homeowners Association may not purchase properties at foreclosure from the planned communities they represent. There's been some basically insider dealing in other states and some of these things where, say, the attorneys know what's going on, and when a lien is foreclosed, they go in and buy the property and have a really good deal. This is simply an attempt to prevent all that.
Mr. Carlson, if I could, and I appreciate that. And again, one of the reasons we brought this up today, we tried to do it before and people couldn't come and we had more time. Now we have less time. But I really wanted to get this out before us on, you know, our due date, so that if there was the possibility that some of these issues could be resolved, we would have a standing with the Senate President to say that we had heard this issue. Clearly, there are issues that need to be addressed. Clearly, that there are issues within these things that need a lot of talking. Yeah. What I would suggest is that, and I know you gentlemen have been talking, I would ask two things. Number one is, are there any of the issues that have been articulated in our brief synopsis here that can be decided in this session with this bill that would be helpful to move forward? And then the broader issues to work on, as Mr. Vile has suggested, in the interim? Or are they also broad that none of them could really be adjusted at this particular time? I'm going to leave it to you to give feedback to Ms. Van Winkle as to either of those scenarios. You know, is there A, some things we can do now, or B, we have to, this whole issue of every part of this has to be done later. We have some working documents now. That's a positive thing. Everybody has to see what the, you know, different points of view are. And I would ask you guys to talk about that and get back to us on that and see if we can move forward or not. Mr. Robbins.
Chair, I look at this legislation as a work in progress because this is going to go on over many years, especially with the growth of population in Oregon, right, and people moving up from California and so on. The problems associated with this are going to be with us, and it'll be a constant or a continuing effort on your part.
Well, I think
do what you can.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear. That's why I'm saying you guys are the certified experts as to whether there are any elements that are standalones that can be done or not. We're going to take feedback from you over the next few days as to whether that is done. Otherwise, we will look at forming a working group for the interim to do the entire issue. Mr. Vile.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, our suggestion was to do the working group on the disclosure issue. Mm-hmm. We believe that all the other issues can and must be addressed now because they represent concerns that have been raised by many members of our constituencies during the interim. And so we would urge the committee to act on all but the disclosure and to act on the disclosure by, in essence, creating the requirement for that committee and a report back.
Okay. Now, what I would say is, and I understand, but again, as I mentioned, you guys have to do the heavy lifting because you're the expertise. You have the experts on that. I definitely am very concerned about the issues Mr. Robbins has raised. I want to make sure that, again, as you know, the homeowners are protected in this, that the association needs tools to be clarified to make it run efficiently. That is done. Mr. Carlson, who's an attorney, it works for us in the majority office. He's going to be the conduit. I'm going to ask him to visit with you about what those things are and get feedback from him as to you know, whether that's good policy or not. And that'll be the linchpin as to whether we can do this during the next month or so. And I'm going to accept that, you know, his judgment on that. So I'll ask you to work with him. Clearly, there's a lot of issues here. I think you have done a lot of work. You both have a lot of, you know, information that you're going to have to be able to convey to us.
Chair Metzger, the only concern I have is that we have essentially agreed with judiciary to move these 900 series bills over so that they can be considered here. I think I know the answer to this, but I just want to make sure that what you're suggesting is not going to jeopardize the opportunity for us to address those issues in the context of 672 by not taking action over in judiciary.
Just so I can make myself clear, I have no control or any influence or any decision to influence anything that's done in the Judiciary Committee. If you want to work independently there, that is up to you, you feel free to do so. But in the context of this committee and our workload and our deadline and something as complicated as this, when I've been working with Mr. Carlson and others for a year on this, this was not an easy thing, and obviously even today, it's clear there's just, and some of these things, as I read through them, are conflicting in terms of notice. Another thing, some are, you know, notice before, some are notice after. I mean, there's just a lot of issues there. And again, I'm going to rely on Mr. Carlson's judgment when he tells me, you know, after talking with you and reviewing all these documents, and I've asked him to really go through all the three judiciary bills that have now been combined and give me an assessment as to, you know, how much heavy lifting there is for this. And if we can do that and you guys are willing to work together, because they would, in this committee, include the issues that Mr. Robbins has brought up. Otherwise, I'm not going to do something that's, you know, homeowners versus those who put together the association and say, I'm going to pick one or the other. No, they have to be integrated so they inure to the benefit of both. Okay? Did I make myself clear? Okay. With that, we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 72. Now, we're going to move to work session Senate Bill 951.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 951 is another Judiciary Committee bill. It revises the motor vehicle liability insurance laws to provide full coverage when a family member passenger is injured in an automobile accident and a family member driver was at fault. This bill also allows policyholders who purchase uninsured motorist coverage over $200,000 to recover from their own UM carrier up to the full amount under the policy when they're injured by a governmental employee on duty or is driving a government-owned vehicle. You have -1 amendments in front of you that were presented at the March 29th hearing when we first heard this bill. What it does is it clarifies a provision of the measure establishing that every automobile liability insurance policy issued for delivery in Oregon will contain a provision that provides liability coverage for family members in the same household equal to the amount of liability coverage purchased by a policyholder.
Thank you, Ms. Pendleton. This was a little tougher one, so we're going to find out where we are. After a brief respite, Mr. Burrell, please come forward. Mr. Jackson.
These are the last three?
No, we have.
Oh. Welcome. How did we do with this bill? This was one that sparked a lot of interest about family members in the same car.
Mr. Chairman, Neil Jackson for the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Unfortunately, we've not been able to reach some kind of a compromise or a consensus. Mr. Merrill and I have spent a lot of time talking over the last few weeks, and basically what he tells me, and he can correct me if I misinterpret, but his company, at least, is not able to come up with the numbers to make a determination actuarially as to what the effect on policy premium costs would be with either one of these. Initially, last week, we thought possibly they couldn't do it with the government vehicle UIM exception, and we thought maybe with the family member they could, but he told me today that they don't have the numbers, so we don't know the effect. So we don't have a consensus on that.
Okay. Mr. Merle.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, I think Mr. Jackson has actually stated that correctly. I just want to know that I did do quite a bit of checking with our actuarial department and even had our head actuary for State Farm look at the issue that Senator Starr actually asked to look into, is what would the difference be if we remove the family member limitation that currently is there? And the word I got back from there is no reliable way to tell what that would do cost-wise. I think you can say that it will increase costs because, of course, you're providing a coverage that isn't currently there today, but they could not quantify that as in a number of gross dollars or a percentage form of either one.
Mr. Merrill, do we have any... because the law has changed in this realm. Do we have any historical data that we could recreate at all? In other words, how would you go about trying to get a determination about what this impact might be?
Senator Messman, that's actually a good question. There have been changes across different states where you've gone, basically what's typically happened is you've had the total exclusion of no coverage to unlimited coverage, as opposed to what Oregon has is kind of a hybrid, which you provide coverage up to the financial responsibility law. We did ask Mr. Trutman to look into that for us, and he said that that's not something they have tracked as a component when it happens in a state. And he said between states, he said if that would be the most logical way to do it, there are so many variables to try to say that's exactly what that did. He said it just is not possible for him to do it. And we did not just rely on him. That was sparked quite a bit of a discussion within the actuarial department in Bloomington, and that was what they came up with, is they really can't have a way. The only way I could see doing it would be you'd have to create an identifier for these claims as they move through the system and then say, okay, this is how much it costs, which there hasn't been a business reason for us to do that, so we haven't.
Right. One thing I would say is that... and I really appreciate all the work all you have done, on short notice on a lot of issues. And I know it's taken just about every hour of your day the last few weeks to these multitude of issues. And I really appreciate how you've come together on so many of these. And, you know, good public policy and understanding the needs of both those who are the recipients of why they buy insurance and those who provide it and try to keep costs relative. This issue, I think, is an important one, even though it's maybe rarely imposed. But I also appreciate that unlike some of our other ones, this one's going to take a little bit more work. So I don't want you to feel that I don't think this is important, and I think the committee would concur this is an important issue with your family. But I don't feel comfortable moving this bill at this time based on both of your assessments of where we are. If by any chance... you know, there's a sufficient will and a light bulb goes off that might provide an avenue, we would have an opportunity, either in this vehicle or other vehicles that will be coming to this committee shortly, to readdress it. And would like you, at the very least, to continue to work on this issue in the interim so that we can bring this back with some solution, if at all possible. Is that satisfactory to you?
That's your message. We'll continue to engage in the dialogue.
Thank you very much for your effort. Senator Deckard.
Thank you. I just feel, it's an equity issue. And so to me, I feel, though I don't know what the actuarial, and I appreciate all the time and energy you probably had to put in to get actually the real numbers. But to me, I'm willing to pay a little bit more. It should be tiny, tiny amount, I would think, to help make sure that family members actually get some coverage. And I don't think we want a big, long discussion on this, but that would just be my two cents. And punting it to the interim does punt it away for 2 years.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that, Senator Deckard. Sometimes things that we want to get done, we have to do that because they are difficult issues. And fortunately, we also have a very good department. And Mr. Ario and others who are involved on a national level with insurance, and we can engage them on helping to try to find some answers and look for some of these solutions for this issue. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 951, open work session on Senate Bill 952. Guess who's here?
Neil Jackson for the Oregon Trial Lawyers. Unfortunately, again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have not been able to find common ground on Senate Bill 952. If the committee recalls, basically what we were trying to do was create a situation where if a person gets hit by an uninsured motorist, they actually have a greater reach of benefits from their own policy than if they get hit from somebody who has a minimum policy, because then they're making an underinsured motorist claim. Unfortunately, again, we've not been able to reach consensus, and we understood that the committee wanted that. We've not been able to do it, and that is recorded as it stands now.
Mr. Merrill, would you kind of give from your perspective the biggest issue here that we haven't been able to resolve and why you think that's a negative for the industry or those who purchase?
Chairman Esco, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Steve Merle. I'm a claim attorney employed by the claim department of State Farm Auto Insurance. This bill, what it would do is it currently under Oregon law, an insurance carrier who pays personal injury protection benefits is allowed to go out and get their money back from the guilty party so long as their insured has their out-of-pocket expenses paid for, and that's current law. What this bill would do is say the person has to be made completely whole before the carrier gets their money back. That's undesirable for two reasons. One is the final cost of PIP insurance is determined by your net cost of what you pay out. So the premiums we calculate are on the net cost. Net cost is what we pay out less what we recover. This would significantly cut into what we would be recovering from other insurance carriers, and therefore would cause the cost of PIP to go up to our individual insureds. That's one cost that this bill would have. The other cost it would have is how do you determine when a person is made whole? And then that would be a new dispute now between the insured and his own company on when that he's made whole and when he's not made whole. And so you'd have a whole new ground of dispute that would cause costs across the legal environment. And for those two reasons, we think this is just a very undesirable bill to be passing out.
Now, one of the things I would think on this one, based on, unlike the other bill we had, you should be able to look at if this bill were law and to review previous claims in your database or other database to get an idea of what the cost difference would have been had this, you know, stacking bill been in effect, and be able to forecast it in some measurable way what impact that might have on the rates for that particular coverage. Would I be incorrect on that?
Chairman Esper, that's probably not bad intuition. I think that the missing component of looking at that, though, is it all hinges on when a person is made whole. And so you have that whole argument of when are you made whole and when are you not made whole. And I've actually been in a state where that was the rule, and that gets to be a ground of considerable dispute. So it's not a quantitative thing where you could say on these claims it would be this way and on these claims they wouldn't. So as far as mining that number, it's very difficult. And then it gets back to there's disputes over that now in those other states.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Questions from Senator Starr? Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Again, this is an issue to work on, and I appreciate the volume of work that we've given you to work together on, and appreciate that. By the way, just to let folks know, the Gremlins and Legislative Council are, in fact, working aggressively on Senate Bill 209 to take care of the amendments that were in there, and apparently it did turn out that Ms. Pellegrini and others had supplied amendments but had not been written, and whether we'll get those or not before the afternoon's up, I don't know, but I wanted to let you know that. All right, so we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 952, and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 955.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 955 Perez from the Judiciary Committee permits a declarant of a condominium to expressly warrant against certain defects in newly constructed units and common elements for not less than 3 years. It limits the applicability of the statute of limitations to 3 years for construction defects when the declarant elects to expressly warrant against certain defects for 3 years. It also requires the election for a three-year warranty, three-year statute of limitations to be disclosed in contract when a condominium unit is sold. But this also applies to warranties and limitations of actions on newly constructed units and common elements delivered into the possession of the unit owner other than the declarant on or after the effective date of the act. You have in front of you dash one amendments that were presented by the bill's proponents on our first hearing of this bill on March 31st. What this does is establishes the declarant to provide to a condominium homeowners association a maintenance and repair plan, and also adds additional provisions on how that maintenance and repair plan is.
Thank you, Ms. Van Winkle. And since you should have in your packets a position paper from the Oregon Real Estate Agency, they're represented here today, and we'll ask for their comments that raise significant concerns on some of the provisions of the bill. I think the first thing I will do is ask the proponents to come forward on their amendment, the dash one amendment. Mr. Pack, welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Barry Pack, and I'm here today representing the Committee to Protect Homeowner Condominium Developers and Homeowners. We are the main proponents of the bill and have the Dash 1 amendments drafted, which make a number of changes to the bill, and I'll just highlight a couple of them that I think are most important in the interest of time. The original bill had a 3-year warranty period and a 3-year liability period, and the amendments changed that to a 3-year warranty and a 4-year liability period to allow for some time for resolution so that homeowners weren't having to file claims on the very last day of their warranty, and there was some time for the developer team and the homeowners to try to address some of the things. The major substantive change that is in addition to the bill as it was originally drafted revolves around maintenance plans. The bill would require a maintenance plan be developed that is not just the stack of pages that I think you saw in our hearing last week, but is actually more of a timeline and schedule with clear delineations of what needs to be done and when, with cost estimates so that the Homeowners Association will, when they take over maintenance of the building, have a clear understanding of exactly what needs to be done to maintain the building. It also would require the Homeowners Association to adopt either that maintenance plan or an alternative plan that they will follow, and that if they do not follow those plans and defects occur because of a lack of maintenance, then the developers aren't held liable for those defects.
Thank you. Mr. Pack, the Dash 1 amendments, and have you seen the analysis by the rest of the
I have, yes. I just got that a little while ago.
And you can understand why the committee would be very concerned about some of the issues, and we will ask Mr. DeMarco to come forward on that in terms of the questions and also how it would, in their belief, adversely impact Oregon consumers. And I'm going to ask him to come up and speak to that issue. If you want to stay here, that would be great. Mr. Bell is going to be testifying as well. I'll start with the agency. Mr. DeMarco, we had heard this bill before, and your position paper says you're really generally neutral on the base bill, and your comments raise flags about the Dash 1 amendments. If you we have your concerns in written form, but if you could articulate them orally to us, we'd appreciate it.
Sure. Chair Metzger, members of the committee, my name is Brian DeMarco. I'm with the Oregon Real Estate Agency. I'm manager for land development and policy coordination. One of my responsibilities at the agency is to review and approve the legal documentation creating a condominium and homeowners association. We, again, as the chair said, we have no concerns one way or the other with the original bill. It's the amendment, the Dash 1 amendment here, that raises a number of issues I'd like to address. Section 3, subsection 1, mandates that the bill, that the declarant provide a detailed maintenance plan. There's also provision that there are regular updates to that plan. It requires the association to hire someone to inspect the premises. And it also requires the association to address all maintenance issues. These provisions increase the cost of housings for the units. The impact may not be felt in the 200-unit building in the Pearl District. It may not be felt in other high-rise condominium unit buildings in other parts of Portland, but it would be adversely affected and impact the owners of those 2- and 3- and 4-unit apartment conversions, your mother, your father, and so on, who are taking their life investment, converting it from an apartment building into a condominium. They would be forced to pay certain costs that, while on their face, may not be much, but whether it's $1,400 or $14,000, it would impact the price of that unit. It would very likely force these people out of the market. Just a nominal increase for these units. They're highly competitive. They're competitive with the one-bedroom condos in the Pearl District that could offer for the same price the views in the Pearl District. More important than just the impact of providing the plan, the impact expense of providing a yearly maintenance, is the phrase, they're required to address all maintenance issues. Now, precisely what does that mean, to address? Does it mean they have to show a list to their homeowners or to the declarant or to whomever and say, look, we looked at these issues, therefore we've done our duty in the law? Or does it mean that they have to spend the money, the expenses, to go through and re-roof if it's a maintenance, or replace tile, or replace light fixtures? That language itself is very vague and is subject to litigation. Disclosure is an important issue. The heart of the sale and marketing requirements of the Oregon Condominium Act is disclosure, and this is not addressed at all in this amendment. Potential purchasers of new units would obviously be on notice. They would know with the right, correct documents, the disclosure statements that are now required, the reserve studies that are now required, that these costs are built into the project. They would have noticed. However, there are a number of condominiums that have been recently created that have not yet gone through their turnover, and I would argue very definitively that we have a problem with the retroactive application of this amendment itself. On its face, the amendment requires the maintenance plan prior to the final year after the turnover. So right now we have a number of condominiums that have been created, legally created, that are out there with the homeowners association that have not yet gone to the turnover meeting. They, in reading the language of the statute, would be subject to this bill. The implementing language at the end on page 4 of the bill, line 15, it says, Section 3 of the Act applies to a maintenance and repair plan adopted by an association of unit owners on or after the effective date. It does not say it applies to condominiums created after this date. There's a big hole right with that sentence. Who or to whom, which associations, which condominiums did this apply to? This notice provision is very important because now all of a sudden you have people who bought their condominium unit a year ago. They bought that based on disclosures made at the time by the declarant that these were going to be the expenses, that this is what you had to go through, this is how the homeowners association was formed. And now somebody comes in and says, we have a state mandate that says we have to do this maintenance plan that's going to cost $1,500, and we have to do this annual inspection that costs $1,000, and we have to rectify all the maintenance problems that who knows what it's going to cost. They had no notice that this was coming up the pike.
Mr. Merkel, you're doing a great job. You're doing so good a job, I'm going to stop you at the moment now. Mr. Vial, do you like the Dashman Amendment?
No.
Okay. Here's the thing. I'm just going to cut to the chase rather than just go through the things. Mr. Pack, we don't like the Dashman Amendments, and to be very honest with you about that. So rather than beat a dead horse, I mean, there are a lot of these things I'm concerned about, and definitely it's not going to move out today with this, and I'm not sure it would move out later. I think we may be able to get Senate Bill 955 out, I just want to make that clear if you have any final comment on that.
Mr. Chair, if I may just respond very quickly. Thank you. I appreciate the questions that were raised. I think that we will be able to sit down and come up with some solutions to these questions. In talking with my client, I think there's a number of questions that have come up that are legitimate and can be addressed, and I think we can find a way to reach an agreement on these.
Okay. Chairman Metzger, earlier on House Bill 672, work group was formed. This also involves disclosure issues. I see no reason why we can't piggyback it on an interim basis.
Well spoken, Mr. DeMarco. Thank you very much. Thank you. Yes, Ms. Bauer.
Chair Metzger, I too would support the idea of going back with Mr. Carlson, addressing these issues in the context of all the other ones.
It makes a lot of sense, yes.
And just for the record, we cannot support 955 without the plan type of amendments. So to pass out 955 without some amendments would not be something we could support. We just can't support this particular set of amendments.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. I'm going to ask one other person to come up. Janet, would you come forward just on the base bill, please? Just because we didn't have the real estate industry on the original bill, we had, I think we have a pretty good understanding of the base bill.
We're moving the base bill.
Yes.
Okay.
Janet, welcome.
Well, thank you. This is, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is what I get for walking in the room at the wrong time.
I think your voice would be welcome on the original Senate Bill 955.
Well, I apologize to you when we were when you pulled me out and we were talking. I thought you were asking me about Senate Bill 672.
Oh,
so that's what I was speaking to you with respect.
Okay.
So if that clarifies that for you. I was simply watching 955 today.
Right. And what is your position on 955?
We have this on a monitor position, just watching to see what kind of amendments come. We have some feelings about it one way or the other, but I haven't looked at the amendments very carefully yet this afternoon, so I would need to do that.
Okay. All right. We're not going to do the amendments, so.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. What would be the pleasure of the committee?
Well, I told the proponents that I would at least try to move the bill, the base bill, as it is, and give them time. And I don't know, Barry, if that's your, if you guys still want to move the base bill, but I don't know where the votes are, but I'm going to try to move the base bill and give them some time and ability to work on on the amendments or.
Well, since we have the same relating clause dealing with the other issue, and we've kept that alive, and there certainly is some concern here on the committee at the moment. So I think it would be prudent to hold the bill for a while until we can see if we could resolve some of those issues. So thank you very much, everyone, on this bill. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 955. And as we motor ahead here on this day...
I got to say you're in my office.
Okay. Where are we going next?
327.
327. Who is this one?
This is
the Morse bill.
Yep, and Jan's here to talk about the amendment.
Oh, that's right.
Yes.
She's talking. Can you talk to her?
I'm okay.
All right, open up the work session, Senate Bill 327. And if you want to come forward, we had this bill before us recently, and I don't know if there was any real particular issues, but just general feeling of concern, and so and see if there's any questions. First of all, committee, you remember this bill. This was the one on debt collection that we had. And, Ms. Van Winkle, why don't you just give us a synopsis of what the bill was?
Yes.
And then I think we'll just see if there's any questions in the committee for Ann before we move forward.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee member, Senate Bill 327 prohibits a debt consolidating agency from receiving a fee from a client until the first installment is paid to the creditor, and also authorizes to charge a credit counseling fee. And it also requires the agency, before providing services to a client, to have them look over and sign a disclosure form. And there's a dash one amendment in front of you which clarifies the language that would be in the disclosure form.
Okay. Jan, do you want to give us just a real synopsis of the dash one amendment?
Jan Amling with Consumer Credit Counseling Service. The dash one amendment is very interesting because we had originally tried to appease some people that were in opposition to our bill from out of state, the people that were doing phone and internet counseling. So we originally wrote the amendment so that it could address a way to get a discrete identifier or to use electronic signatures. Legislative Council didn't care for that way to deal with it and basically wanted to put the bill back to its original position. So that the bill is, the dash one is marginally different than the original bill. But there is one change that I noticed. It says on page 3, line 5, deleted credit counseling and inserted services. And this was also another issue that some of the out-of-state places had is actually where is the definition of credit counseling and what does it comprise? So by using services, it kind of eliminates that by saying that before you provide services, you just tell people what your fees are instead of hashing out what is credit counseling.
So you would prefer the dash one?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, I just want to get that clarified. Questions from the committee for Jan?
I move the dash one amendments to 327.
Senator Starrs moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 327. Any objection? Senator Starr?
Move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 327 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. Thank you, Jan, for coming back. Okay, what do we have before us now? Oh, Senator Morris will carry. Thank you very much. Okay. I think what we're going to do here, have you seen these amendments to 209? We're going to return to open the work session on 209.
They're looking at them right now, so I don't...
Okay, let's... You look at them. You continue to look at them. I'm going to close the work session on 209. I love these last days.
I hope that's true.
Yeah. Let's open up a work session, Senate Bill 385.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 385 directs the appraiser certification and licensure board to use standard procedures in conducting nationwide criminal records checks and also authorizes the board to discipline state registered appraiser assistants. It also reorganizes the enforcement powers, and there's an emergency clause on the bill. You have dash two amendments in front of you that removes the fingerprinting provisions of the bill because the board is lumped into an omnibus bill that's currently in the House Judiciary Committee, I believe. And Bob Keith, who's the administrator, is here to answer any questions.
Mr. Keith, if you'd come forward, please. Welcome. If you could give us a synopsis of what the Dash 2 amendments do and your position on that.
Yes, thank you, Senator Metzger, Chair Metzger, and members of the committee. I came before the committee on March 1st and testified about the bill, and then I met with some of the senators individually to explain why we needed the Dash 1 amendments. Subsequent to those two events, opposition arose against a portion of our bill by the American Civil Liberties Union, specifically with respect to the fingerprints. Part of the reason why they were opposed to the bill was because there is a bill, House Bill 2157, that's currently in the House, that would satisfy our need for fingerprints, and it's a collective effort the ACLU is involved with. And so what we've done is we'd like to adopt the Dash 2 amendments, which essentially completely eliminates the nationwide criminal records check fingerprints from the original bill in the interest of moving the rest of the components of the bill forward.
Okay, thank you. And there's been a lot of work going on between these two wings on that issue on a number of, because I've been involved with a couple of them, Senate Bill 360 or whatever, a few other ones. So what we have done here, colleagues, is to delete that issue, let it work its way through in another form, return simply to the certification license support procedures. Is there any questions that any of you have on the base bill or the Dash 2 amendments, which delete Section 5, the fingerprint aspects of this bill?
That's all that section is the Dash 2 is.
Well, there's some other, I think the other ones are pretty well. Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Keith? Senator Starr was asking, other than the fingerprint issues, what are the other deletions out of the Dash 2s?
The only thing we're attempting to do is just eliminate the nationwide criminal records check portion of the base bill. So that comes out entirely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 385.
Senator Starr has moved Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 385. Discussion on that.
Is there a general fund, Mr. Chair, involved with any of this?
Mr. Keith?
Yes, that's correct. There, originally, Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, when we became a semi-independent agency in 1991, inadvertently, the language was left from another bill that it was basically patterned after, which caused civil penalties to go into the general fund. We're one of eight or nine other semi-independent agencies that are also licensing boards, and they have all had their civil penalties that they receive and to help offset the cost of licensing and enforcement activities. And so what we're attempting to do is to correct that.
Just follow up. How much?
64.
Yes, Senator Melissa Anderson. Yes, but there was a fiscal that was issued at the first hearing in the $64,004 next to
Biden. I just don't. For some reason, have.
No, not at all. Any other questions? Any objections to the amendment? The order.
Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move the bill as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 385 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Further discussion.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Any $64,000 doesn't have to go to Ways and Means?
No. We have no Ways and Means referral on it. I'm sure if someone down the road wants to do something with that when they move over the house, I guess they could do that.
They can do that.
Any objection? Toward.
Thank you.
Okay. So, Senator Monis Anderson, would you carry that? It just feels like my workload is carrying bills, and you're so good at doing these.
Okay.
Would you do that?
I will do that.
I couldn't find a name on that bill that I could stick it with. Okay. Rock and roll. Let me see where we are. So we just did
327.
So we're down to at least 10-12. Okay. Oh, okay. Emergency small business, 10-08.
And 209.
Okay. What I think we will do is we're in work sessions on 10-17.
Oh, no.
No, we're not doing 10-17. So I apologize, folks. This is a very disjointed day. 173 we have. Well, I don't have a quorum here, so I'm thinking about which ones I need to do or whether we should just stand in at ease for a while. Okay, our emerging small business one, we actually do need Senator Starr here for that one. The 10-08 is a presentation. I think we'll do that one. So let's open the public hearing on...
Except Senator Deckard's doing it, and he's not here.
That's right, and he's
not here. He's not here.
Can you believe that? Who else? Gary, is any of you else with 10-08? I mean, anybody else on this issue who would want to comment? Okay, I just don't know who's all involved, so... what we're going to do, members, we're going to stand in recess until the quorum returns, and then we hope to pursue the final three bills on the agenda. We're actually... Ms. Van Winkle.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Senate Bill 173 modifies the criteria for businesses who wish to be certified as an emerging small business by the Department of Consumer and Business Services and allows the reinstatement of a formerly certified business if the business still qualifies as an emerging small business and has remaining eligibility. It abolishes the emerging small business account within the Consumer and Businesses Service Fund and transfers the money to the emerging small business account in the State Highway Fund. It also, that's it, and there are no amendments.
Okay. This is, committee, we remember this bill from our first hearing, and there was a number of concerns just about how this organization was operating. Was it really serving minority women and minority-owned businesses, small businesses? Could they access the system? And we asked Mr. Marsh to get some answers for committee members and also asked him to provide those to you, and I believe he has done that. And I've asked him to come forward and give us a synopsis of, and I appreciate the material that you provided us, and on clarifying the changes that have taken place in this group.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. And yes, I think in the first hearing we addressed most of the items that dealt directly with the bill, but there were significant concerns about the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business and whether the needs were being met of the contractor community in this regard. You have a letter from myself dated April 4th, which goes through the certification process and the changes that have been made by the office. And just let me briefly summarize a few of those. They have consolidated the certification process so that it goes a three-year term instead of a one-year annual renewal process. They have established a one expiration date for those firms that have multiple certifications, and they're also moving to online applications, which would allow for internet access and doing the process through the internet rather than having to do it through hard copy. Many other changes have also been made, Mr. Chair. There was also a survey of those firms that were involved in the process, which came out with high marks on their knowledge, professionalism, and responsive nature of the work that was done. So we feel like it addresses most of the concerns of the committee, and if there are other questions, we're open to those.
Okay. We're working to actually provide Senator Starr with a copy of the letter.
I have one here, too.
That'll probably be even more efficient.
Right.
I'm not sure why I don't have anything from him in my file here. From the previous hearing.
I know both Senator Deckard and Senator Atkinson also had some questions, and did you have an opportunity to visit with?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we visited with both the senators and discussed concerns, and then this document was developed as the response to those concerns.
Okay. There's no opposition to this bill.
Mr. Chair, not aware of any opposition, and AGC is here, as well as I have the head of the Office of Minority Women and Emerging Small Business, Raleigh Lewis, if there are questions.
Mr. Marsh, and I appreciate your understanding of this rather interesting day here in the Senate, and I do appreciate you taking the opportunity to touch base with the issues. I raised some of them myself, and Senator Deckard, Senator Atkinson, and of course they're not here at the moment, and I know you have circled back with them in particular because I asked you to do that, and so I hate to have you speak for them, but just for the record, since they're not here, at least your perspective of that, do you feel that those issues have been rectified in terms of their mind based on your discussions with them?
Mr. Chair, of course, that's a dangerous business to speak for elected officials, but let me indicate that there were significant concerns that related to issues from 2 to 3 years ago that dealt with customer service, customer satisfaction by the office. These survey responses, we think, respond to that and show that things have changed in the last couple of years. And in order to validate what occurred a year ago in their most recent survey, we did go out and ask folks who have been certified in the last few months just to see if there's anything different. And the information coming back there also corroborated a degree of customer satisfaction by those folks. The other concern that was expressed by the other senators did relate to the number of contracts out there and whether we are getting enough work out to folks in emerging small businesses. And we feel that element is being addressed by the opportunities that are coming forward by the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, as well as information that we provide in the letter about entities other than ODOT who are also contracting in pretty significant ways. And the statistics show from the firms themselves that they've been getting contracts.
Thank you. Would a representative from AGC please come forward? You could stay there, Mr. Marsh. I want to make sure I'm comfortable with this, but because of the fact that I have a minimal quorum, I just want to make sure that I get this on the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris-Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We remain in support of Senate Bill 173. We believe it's a good bill and will help small and emerging small business firms. It's our understanding, the money that will be transferred will be used to help create additional opportunities through smaller contracts for those firms. And so we support that. We represent many small minority and emerging small business firms, and we believe ODOT works hard to create those kind of opportunities for small firms as well as other agencies, and support this legislation in trying to consolidate the process. We appreciate the efforts that ODOT has undertaken to smooth that process along, and we look forward to continuing to work with them to make that process even better over time.
Thank you very much. Questions of the committee? Okay. Well, we're in a work session on 173.
There's no amendments?
No.
No amendments.
Move Senate Bill 173.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 173 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Thank you.
You betcha. I think I'm going to assign Senator Deckert to carry the bill because he's not here. Now, we are down to two bills, one of which is that correct? Yes.
Yes.
One is going back to 209, which is the abnormal disruption of market, with the amendment that our legislative council has miraculously been able to produce. Thank you, Harrison, for doing that. And then we're going to have a brief presentation by Senator Deckert on the status of Senate Bill 1008. I think I will begin by bringing Ms. Pellegrini and Mr. Harrison. Harrison, would you come forward with Ms. Pellegrini? We have this amendment. You've had during our time here, at least you've had an opportunity to review to see whether this does contain the information on it. Welcome again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, Oregon Department of Justice, and thank you to the committee administrator, Ms. Van Winkle, and to Legislative Council for producing the Dash 2 amendments.
So would you please review those with us, Ms. Pellegrini? If we have any other technical questions, Harrison could answer those for us.
Yes.
What are the material changes now from the original bill with the amendment of the Dash 2?
They are as follows, and I would identify concerns as they come up. We added motor vehicle fuel to the list of essential goods and services in Section 1, Subsection 4C of the bill, and this was an issue raised by both you, Mr. Chair, and by Senator Starr. We removed contractors from the list of essential services in Section 1, Subsection 4A, but kept residential building materials and supplies in the list of essential goods and services, and then removed the reference to contractors as it appeared in other places in the bill, to make clear that the bill now applies to merchants and wholesalers, building materials, and supplies, but not contractors or the services that contractors themselves provide. We added a provision in Section 3, Subsection 2, that states that a proclamation of an abnormal disruption of the market must specify a geographical area on a county-by-county basis, and this is to address a concern raised by Senator Deckert that the proclamation only apply to a designated scope of area. So it's a county-by-county proclamation. We added a provision in Section 3, Subsection 4, that states that a proclamation terminates 30 days after it's made and may be renewed for one additional 30-day period by further proclamation of the governor. And that was a concern raised by Senator Starr, that the proclamation should last no longer than is necessary to protect consumers while allowing the market to adjust. The current language of the bill also vests the legislature with the authority to terminate or extend the proclamation at any time, and that provision was not modified at all. We added the phrase additional labor costs. This is on page 2 of the dash 2s, and it is line 8, which would include a business that would need to hire an additional workers or to pay overtime to the list of additional costs that might be imposed upon a business in the wake of an abnormal disruption of the market in Section 4, Subsection 3A, and which would increase the business's cost to operate. Additional labor costs would then be a factor with other additional costs, such as transportation, that may be incurred in procuring goods or services and which could constitute an affirmative defense to a claim made by the Attorney General that the business had engaged in price gouging. Finally, in Section 4, Subsection 4, and this is on page 2, beginning at line 10 of the dash 2s, we added what we would call safe harbor language to the bill. And this addresses concerns that the bill in its original form didn't provide a business with the opportunity to come forward in advance of being investigated or being the subject of a lawsuit by the Attorney General, to come forward with information to the Attorney General to demonstrate that it anticipated that it was going to have to necessarily raise prices due to the event that caused the proclamation, and that that price increase may constitute an increase of 20% or more, and in effect to get an advance ruling from the Attorney General about whether or not the reasons for the price increase would fall within the exceptions included in the bill, so that once the price increases were put into effect, it would not thereafter become the subject of an investigation. The way that that we contemplated this working in the dash 2s is that in advance of an anticipated price increase, a merchant or wholesaler may submit evidence to establish that the proposed price increase is attributable to one of the more of the circumstances described in the bill, necessary cost incurred as a result of the event, or it's a price increase that was occasioned by something that in fact had nothing to do with the event but was some other purpose altogether. And that upon receipt of a request and evidence under Section 4, the Attorney General may evaluate the evidence and make a determination about whether or not it's sufficient to establish that the proposed price increase would create an exception. And if we do not respond, if the Attorney General does not respond within 4 calendar days after receipt of a request for review, then a subsequent price increase in and of itself cannot be considered to be prima facie evidence of price gouging. And what that means is that the Attorney General would then have to undertake an independent investigation to develop facts to show that the price increase was not attributable to any market conditions or any other price. So in other words, the burden would shift to us to develop the case and bring it before. We could not simply go into court, show the 20% price increase, and get a temporary restraining order. So we came up with that. That this is alternative language to language that was submitted to us by Mike Dewey. And it's a little bit more developed than Mr. Dewey's language, and it would apply to any merchant or wholesaler.
Well, Ms. Pellegrini, I appreciate that. We have, a number of us have been working with the department and other stakeholders on this issue. I think this is very good public policy, but it's complicated because of the, well, what if scenarios that we kept discussing with various ones, including Mr. Dewey and others. And I thought it was really, really critical. I think with Senator Deckert and Senator Starr's amendments that are included here are really good. And I think also the issue that that we worked on that I think is really important, that I know you've done your best in putting this together, is that safe harbor language, you know, that would cover broad, not just one industry, but give an opportunity for the fact that to be able to submit evidence, you know, about this so someone isn't tagged with it. And I think narrowing, I think we had talked about 7 days, so narrowing it down to the 4 days that the Attorney General would have is also helpful for those people trying to get product in and not wanting to be accused of price gouging. So I really do appreciate your efforts. These are the types of bills that I think no one's really going to think much about until the unthinkable happens. And certainly I don't want us to be in a situation whenever that time comes and someone says, well, how come, you know, no one ever addressed this issue? And I know you've addressed it for many years, but I think this is a lot better than any of the other factors that we and enumerations of this that we have seen. So I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? We've got counsel here, and we also have the Department of Justice.
Mr. Chair, did we put the gas issue in there?
Yes. We took out the contractors and replaced it with the gas.
Where's Romaine?
Oh, Mr. Romaine is quiet at the moment.
All right. Giddy up.
Any other questions? Thank you. Well, we're in work session on Senate Bill 209 with a dash 2 amendment.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 209. Discussion. Objection. Order. Senator Starr. Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 209 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. Order. All right. Who would like to carry this pro-consumer bill on the floor?
Harrison has it.
Harrison will carry.
Mr. Chair,
before we name a carrier, let's name Harrison.
Harrison Conley, Deputy Legislative Counsel. Since I did come to the front, I wanted to comment. You mentioned the miraculous production of this draft, and you called my name. I just thought I should take this opportunity to say that when you get miracles from our office, it's really about our publication services staff. They're the ones who just do fantastic work to turn these things around in that kind of time, so I wanted to make sure that they get the credit for getting you this dash 2, not me.
Thank you very much, and that is well noted, and you're right. They do a great job back there, and we try not to impose, well, some of us try not to impose on them for everything to be an emergency, so when we do, that they will produce that, and the committee is very grateful for them doing that. So out there in TV land, if you're back there, thank you very much. Okay, anyway, we were talking about a carrier for the bill. By the way, I signed a bill for you because you were gone. Anybody would like to carry this bill in particular?
Well, someone's missing. That's your criteria.
I think I'll carry the bill. Oh, my goodness. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate everything. We are down to the last bill of the day, and that is Senate Bill 108, and we're going to open an informational hearing on Senate Bill 108 and ask Senator Deckert to make his presentation. Just a reminder, this is the bill that a lot of folks were spending a lot of hours on and working very, very hard to establish the Oregon Community Power, the opportunity for a a statewide purchase of Portland General Electric, and the committees have been working hours and hours and days trying to come up with this and establish a product that we can take to the Senate floor. What I asked Senator Deckert to do would be to give us an update on where we are in that process. We do expect to have this bill before us for hearing and work session very, very soon. But I wanted to ask Senator Deckert if he could update the committee on where we were. Senator Deckert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to give the two-minute if I could, and it's been a long, long day, and so I'll give the 1 or 2 minute update, and then I think we're up Tuesday again, and we'll bring all this work group that you helped assign. And so here's who's been. We've been over at AOI meeting for literally, I don't know what the hour total is, but it is just countless and countless hours. The members of that work group have been Mark Nelson and Brad Cleaves representing ICNU, Jason Eisendorf and Jeff Bissonette representing CUB, Julie Brandis with AOI, and has been a gracious host and has prepared many salads, and will get you extra ranch if you need it, which is very, very kind, at least from my point of view. Gary Conkling, Tom Bryan, and Dennis Mulvihill, representing at least part of the county perspective. Sandy Flicker, Don Goddard, and Tom O'Connor representing the customer-owned utilities, and then Scott Bolton has joined the group representing PacifiCorp and the investor-owned utility perspective. We have a separate group that has been meeting, and that is the treasurer, Doug Goh, and the attorney general, and they've had, I know, one and maybe two meetings just talking about the revenue bond and actually the acquisition. So, Mr. Chair, where we're at, and we'll talk more about this Tuesday, is we've been hard at work really defining, and the customer groups get a lot of the credit for doing the definition of what this public corporation model would look like. The goal has always been to marry the public mission and the benefits of a public mission and an entity that looks and feels like a private corporation, hopefully getting you the best of both worlds. Obviously, the public mission benefits, similar to OHSU or the Port of Portland in terms of public corporations, is A, the cost of money. You're just going to pay significantly lower interest rates on a big acquisition. Secondly, the way we stipulate, and we'll talk more about this on Tuesday, is that state and federal taxes, this entity obviously would not pay state and federal taxes, but would plow those savings into ratepayers' pockets in terms of reduced rates by statute. And then third, and we'll talk about the governance process, but it would be governed for the benefit of ratepayers. And so unlike other entities, this would be very much focused on what is, I would, and I think we'll make this argument crystal clear, hopefully, on Tuesday, is that if you look at the economy of Oregon and where we have advantages, we could certainly say workers' comp, hopefully a corporate tax structure that incents investment here. And then thirdly, has traditionally been our power rates. And so this is in the back of our minds of ensuring if we're going to entice companies and economic development here, one of the strategic advantages we've traditionally had, it hasn't been so great in the last few years, but one of our traditional strategic advantages in terms of enticing companies to locate here has been energy prices, and this is an effort to help secure that advantage through time. So that's what we'll bring you. We'll bring you a governance model. We're done with the, or at least I shouldn't say done, but we've taken a first big stand stab at what that governance model would look like, and we'll bring that to the committee on Tuesday. We'll define what the rate setting process would be, and we'll also talk about how we handle the local property and state and federal tax issue. We'll be prepared, I think, to talk about how the revenue acquisition, the revenue bonds, would be at least our first go at how those would be structured. But the good news, at least from the treasurer's office, is this is something the state knows a lot about, and it's a pretty simple clean, although you have to define your animal to get the to bring the bond rating agencies in. But it is a pretty simple clean because you use, on all of these proposals, the customers are going to buy this utility. We know that very, very clearly on any proposal. And so this is one that they would buy it, and then they would own it. And the acquisition should be a pretty clean acquisition.
Thank you. Any questions for Senator Deckert at this point?
I do need to put one thing out. I was told today by the President's office we can't post any Senate bills that we're carrying over on Tuesday. So we will get permission. So probably the earliest we can do is Thursday. But Senator Messer needs to talk to the President first and go over all that. So just to let you know.
We have, for all those out there, we have already pre-discussed with the President these bills because they're very significant, and I didn't want to even attempt to do any of these issues in this session today, as you could tell. Doing a pro forma hearing on something like that would not be appropriate, and we need, now that we've moved things that are in the process moving along, we're going to have an opportunity to give the time that this committee needs to give to those energy issues and make sure we have good public testimony and time for everybody to comment on that rather than little snapshots. But as Teresa mentioned, the president said they want to meet with all the chairs on Monday to again review those bills and so our posting, so it will be Thursday. But we'll have the opportunity then to actually not be rushed with a lot of other items. I intend to have that bill and also 671, which we had heard before, the folks who are working on the mutualization issue, and provide an opportunity to focus on energy issues in the committee and present those to us. So again, thank you for all the hard work. We will have a limited schedule on Tuesday. It'll be a short committee hearing with a few House bills. Thank you all for your great work today. It's just been a real heckish day to do everything, and I appreciate, although dysfunctional in order at times, I think it served us well that we had a chance to have all these hearings earlier. So with that, the committee is adjourned.